Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Morelia Python Radio, sponsored by Morelia Python Forums.
Sponsors now.
Yeah, the absolute best forum for carpets and other Morelia. It's at www.moreliapythons.com. So go over there, sign up, get involved. If you want to know about carpets or anything regarding Morelia, or even pythons for that matter, there's some really, really smart guys and girls over there that know what they're talking about when it comes to Python. So go over and check it out. I'd like to get the chat thing going again when we're doing the show. So hopefully we'll get
start
that going.
Start the shark pool up again, yeah.
Yeah, we know how you like that.
Brutal.
Tonight we have a very, very cool guest on. He's probably well known for his ball pythons more than he is for carpet pythons or Morelia, but he is one of the largest reptile breeders in the world. And I wanted to have him come on and talk about what it's like to run a reptile business and get his feel from the maybe outside of the Morelia world on the pulse of carpet pythons and see, you know, how they fare against everything else to see if there's any kind of interest or anything like that. Not to mention Snake Bites TV. That's absolutely a really cool little vodcast that
we must mention. Yes,
that's right. I remember back in I think it was 2008 or 2009 whenever it first came out. I was fishing around the net and came up with that, and I've been watching them every Wednesday since. So you know, that's a pretty cool. So yeah, it's Brian Barczyk. He's coming on from BHB Reptiles. So
very cool.
Yes. So what's going on, Owen?
Oh, nothing. we're getting closer and closer to hatch date over here for my caramel tigers. So, you know, I pulled myself away from staring at the eggs for 5 seconds to do the show, and I'll go back to sitting there looking at them afterwards.
Caramel tigers. We might have something that we might have to trade for, you know, because you're going to have a
I figured.
You might need a zebra jag coming up soon.
Stop that. No, I've already been tempted with mixings and mutts already, okay? The second I get that clutch on the ground, I'm going to kill myself. Anyway, but another cool thing I forgot to mention to you is that my snakes are going to be in a movie.
Oh, cool.
So, yes. A friend of mine through work shoots movies and has this story where there are creatures that need to move like snakes. So he's going to end up filming all my snakes and then CG CGI-ing them into these little plant-like monsters. And I'm like, oh, all right, cool. So he said he's going to give me this whole video of how he's going to do it step by step. So it's going to be cool to watch.
to see
how he goes from filming my guys to, you know, turning them into monsters. And I'm like, oh, that's awesome. So
very cool. Rogue Reptiles on the B-horror flick list.
yeah, why not? And, like, you know, he's like, oh, I want some snakes that, like, you know, might want to, like, stand up and do different cool things. I'm like, great. That means I got to go deal with a Max and, you know, a female that hates my guts. Let's just pull her out and let her be herself and they'll get what they want.
Cool.
So, and then they're also talking about shooting my Malukans, which I told you a story of. I found out just how long or how much of a strike distance my Malukans have. My friend Chris was nailed in the face by one of our Malukan scrubs because he was four foot away from where a friend of mine was holding it. So I'm like, okay, normal carpet strike range is not what these guys have. So, oh, my God, fast, like, you didn't even see it. It was insane. And I'm like, okay. Wow. So
that had to hurt.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what? Chris is one of those guys that if it bites him, it bites him in the face. I don't know why, but every animal tends to bite him in the face. So it seems to have worked out.
Okay. Very cool. Or not for him, but, you know.
Yeah, it sucks for him, but who cares?
Let's see. As far as anything, I mean, there's a lot of carpet pythons hatching out right now, so
everywhere.
Some pretty cool stuff. You know, we got their first sun glow last week, and we talked about that. They had I seen some granites and oh, just on a side note, did you see Chris Behoff's pairing that he's going to do for next year with Jungles? Good Lord. You didn't see that? Yeah.
No.
Go look at that on Facebook and talk about some killer Jungles. I mean, you can't get any more yellower or any more black.
Does it involve Johnny Blaze?
Yes.
Then I'm interested already.
Yes.
I don't care what it is. I want it.
Yeah. So that's some pretty cool things. On the Bolan Python front, I think his name is David, but he goes by Notum on the Morelia Pythons forum. But he had the female that he thought was Gravit.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, he was palpating her, and he felt 11 eggs inside of her, and they were high up in the body near the ovaries. And there was some speculation of they didn't go through the mushy stage. That's what he calls it. But he's
technical terms we have here at Carpet Python World.
Yeah.
The mushy stage.
She just recently shed, and they've moved down into the lower part of her body. And that's, you know, where the eggs usually move when the snake is Gravit.
Right.
He said they're about 1 to 2 inches. And he can easily feel them when he's palpating, but she's eating.
Mm-hmm.
So
well, sometimes they do. It's okay.
Yeah. So he was thinking either there was a couple of things that he was thinking. Either one, they were infertile, or she's not as far along as he thought. So, you know,
how many Bolin's pregnancies do we have to look at? I mean, you and I were talking to, never mind. And we found out that, what was it, the cannonbars? Yeah, that like they're the 80 days or something it took for them to hatch. And it wasn't cannonbars. What am I thinking?
I don't know.
How do I? Damn it.
That was scrub pythons.
Right, skip that. Moving on. Scrub something, yeah.
Yeah. Barnex. Yeah.
Whatever.
Kind of like retic. But
I don't know. I don't have retics. I'm not stupid.
So yeah, that's pretty cool. So hopefully, I really hope that this is the year that he hatches them out. So
yeah, because you want to buy some of those. That's why you're looking at it.
Oh my God, do you know how? I think if the first time I ever hatched Bolans, I don't think I would sell any of them. It'd be hard to sell them. You know. So
like I was interested in buying the Bolans. Too freaking bad.
Yeah.
So is Behoff's pairing Johnny Blaze and what was it, Lemon IO or something?
Yes.
Dear God, it burns my eyes to look at it.
Yeah, it's
that's fantastic.
Nice.
I want a girl. I want a girl from that pairing. Chris, when you don't notice,
yeah.
I want one.
So, there was a possible new Woma morph. I don't know if you saw that on the forum, but that was pretty cool. Pretty much patternless.
I've seen patternless before.
Yeah, this is pretty neat looking. And apparently hatched whoever, I can't remember who it was that hatched them out, but whoever it was, they'd done it before, so they're trying to do that. Brian's on the line there, and we're going to catch him on in a minute, but I just wanted to hit on MorelliaPythonRadio.com is up and running, so you can go to www.MorelliaPythonRadio.com. Also, I put up, because we're getting ready, www.CarpetFest.com. And,
oh, God, it's a yearly thing now.
Yes, it is.
To deal with you people more. I mean, good.
So, you know, we're going to get that going so everybody can check that out. And, you know, this year, the next year, we're going to try to get a vet to come down. And Howard's going to try to get Scott. I can't remember his last name, but he's a pretty well-known vet in the reptile world. And he's going to get him to try to do like a Q&A session. I know there was talk of having Nick come and give a little lecture on Morelia or carpets or whatever, but
a little lecture. Let's be realistic here.
And then you know, just promoting the hell out of it for the next year. So hopefully it's in May, but me and Howard will pick out a date and go from there. But you know, we raised the $1,500 for just shy of $1,500 for US ARC. So hopefully next year we can raise a little more and we'll be a little more organized and we'll be cool.
Yes. And on that note, I'm finding out people made out like freaking bandits at the auction. The Moe Tiger female that was that went out, that was at the auction.
Yeah.
Yeah, those pictures were posted up on the forums and it shed out and it looks fantastic.
Oh,
I'm like, God damn, I should have done that. Damn it. So people are definitely, it's just to come and hang out and participate in the auction. It's worth it. Oh, my God.
Yeah, we ain't going to mention what Mo walked away with, but good.
No, we can't mention what Mo walked away with.
Yeah.
We are all sworn to secrecy.
But it's definitely worth it to come out. So.
Eric's animals. I mean, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So without any further
ado and hoopla, yeah.
Yeah, we'll bring Brian on. Hey, Brian, how you doing? Welcome to the show.
Hey, guys, what's going on, man? Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it, guys.
Nothing much.
Doing all right.
Cool.
Definitely our pleasure. So, Brian, we normally ask everybody this one question just to get us off rolling, and that is, how did you get into reptiles?
Oh, gosh. How long
is
this show? You know, honestly, God, I've told this story before, and it's the real truth that, you know, my first memory as a person was actually, my mom tells me I was 2 years old, and she took me to a local zoo called the Belle Isle Aquarium, and I literally can remember it like it was yesterday, and I remember seeing what was a ball python, and literally, I mean, that's like my earliest memory in my life was a ball python at the Belle Isle Aquarium, and really, I was just fascinated. What's really interesting, guys, is that like no one, my family's not an animal family. Like I didn't have a pet my entire childhood,
wow.
You know, and so it wasn't like, you know, I don't know where this animal gene and more importantly, reptile gene came from, because it wasn't like it was taught to me or anything like that. I just was fascinated with snakes and fascinated with all animals, but in particular snakes my whole life. Like I said, going back to when I was 2 years old, and by the time I was 5 or 6, there was a patch of woods behind our house, and I would spend, you know, every day in the, you know, when it was nice outside catching garter snakes, you know, and my mom wouldn't allow snakes in my house, our house. So literally, you know, I had like a, a cardboard box in the garage with dirt and tree limbs and all kinds of other stuff. And I had like 20 garter snakes out there in my garage that I would feed. I mean, this is like 5 and 6 years old. And I didn't have anyone teaching me anything or showing me anything. So that's how I got it. I mean, it's in my blood, you know. I mean, and it's just, you know, I was born to work with reptiles. That's what I always tell people.
Awesome.
Well, wow,
we definitely have expanded from the cardboard box in the garage.
A little bit.
Well, why don't you give us a little overview of BHB reptiles? Tell us what's going on, all that. How to get started.
Well, you know,
all that stuff.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's an interesting thing. You know, I really never aspired to be a professional snake breeder or anything like that. That wasn't, you know, a goal. You know, I always tell people that when I started out, there wasn't a professional reptile breeder, nobody, you know. I mean, there was no one. I remember Eugene Bissett, when he quit his job, like the buzz in the hobby, you know, just, you know, people, oh my gosh, you believe Eugene quit his job to be a full-time reptile breeder? And that was like the first guy that was actually quote unquote a professional reptile breeder. And so I was just a kid at the time, like 17 years old. And you know, I was just keeping snakes because I loved them, and I did buy a pair of albino Burmese pythons from Mark Bell for $3,200 for the pair, which was like every dime I had to my name for every paper route, you know, everything. And you know, I thought maybe I could make a few bucks to help pay my way through college. And by the time I was in my second year of college, I was, you know, had my snakes in my parents' basement, and you know, I was making like $40,000 a year out of the basement. And I thought to myself, you know, I was finishing up my second year and thought, man, this is really what I want to do with my life. Let's give this a go. And here we are 20-something years later. And you know, it has its ups and downs. There's no doubt about that. But you know, I always say that I love what I do. You know, I don't always love the business. You know, I what I mean by that is the politics and the ups and downs and the pressures and the stresses mm-hmm. that come along with doing something like this. But there's never, and I mean this wholeheartedly, there has never been a day in the last 20-something years that I've not wanted to go to my shop and work. You know, I mean, every day I get excited about coming into work. I wake up in the morning, and you know, I can't imagine what normal people, you know, that hate their jobs wake up in the morning and go, oh, man, it's Monday morning. I got to go to the shop. You know, because I've never had that feeling, which is, you
right.
know, and so that's the way it is.
Wow, that's great. Now, awesome. Most of us dream of waking up and, you know, going and working with keeping or breeding reptiles for a living, you know. And what would you recommend to somebody who wants to start out in this business?
You know, it's a strange thing. Over the years, and I hate to sound like an old timer because I don't feel like I'm an old timer, but I've been around for 20-something years. I've seen a lot of people, and I know you guys have too. You know, I've seen a lot of people come and go on the hobby, whether it's, you know, mm-hmm. trying to do it as a living or even just keeping stuff as a hobby and come and go. And I think the hardest thing is when you take something that you're really passionate about and you love as a hobby and you turn it into a job. You know, sometimes that really steals the passion away. And I've seen it happen to all levels, you know. I mean, from guys that just have small collections that decide to do it, you know, to make money and put the pressure on, to guys that are doing it big commercial operations. And I've seen them burn out on the actual animal part and the passion part. And that's what I always, you know, tell people, if you want to do this for a living, make sure this is really what you want to do for a living. You know what I mean? It's like, because you have to take the good, the bad, the ugly, and all those things. And when you're producing a clutch of carpet pythons or producing a clutch of ball pythons or corn snakes or whatever it might be, and it's kind of for fun, and you've got a job that's paying your bills, it's like, wow, it's just a great experience. But then when you're doing it as a business and you're relying on it to pay your bills and to make your overhead, and then that animal slugs out or your odds turn out terrible or, you know, you don't get what you're – it's really difficult to deal with those types of issues. So you have to always say, like, to do it really well is, like, you have to be so uber passionate about it that you can look beyond. And somehow – you know, I always tell people from 8 in the morning till – 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I run a business, and from 4 o'clock to 8 o'clock, when I'm usually at the shop, I'm a hobbyist, you know, because I don't answer the phones, you know, I'm in my shop alone, I don't have employees, I'm just in there, and I'm back to opening up drawers and looking at animals and enjoying those things. And that's been the secret for me, is to just keep keep that passion going and realize that why I do what I do is because I love what I do, not for the money, and it never has been or never will be. And maybe that's why I'm not a great business person. You know, I mean, I always say I'm a terrible business person, I think, because, you know, I'm really just a hobbyist that's gone kind of crazy, you know. And but that's the advice I always give people is just, you know, really make sure that you want to do this and don't ever put the money in front of the animal's welfare. And those are things I see a lot of people making a lot of mistakes on when they make the transition from hobbyist to professional breeder. It's a difficult transition, and most, quite honestly, as you guys are probably well aware, most people fail at it. You know, most people can't make that transition. And whether they hang in there for 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, you know, eventually they fall off, you know. And very few people actually make it a lifetime, you know. And so you know, that's my advice.
You know, it's funny, Brian, you talk about passion, and I remember hearing you back on Reptile Radio and Snake Blades TV, and one of the things you always talked about was passion, and you kind of were the person that directed me personally to go into carpet pythons, because, you know, it didn't seem back then like everybody really even cared what a carpet python was, but for whatever reason, they just did it for me, you know, and, you know, that's what guided me into carpet pythons, and, you know.
Well, that's awesome, and that's what I think is important, you know what I mean? I always tell people, I work with a lot of snakes, you know, and I don't work with anything I don't like, you know, literally. I'm not kidding you, and I've gotten in and out of projects many, many times that and took financial beatings on those projects just because I didn't like it, you know what I mean? It's like I go, oh, I really want to get into this project, and I spend a whole bunch of money, and I get the animals, and I just don't like working with them, and I just get rid of them. I'm just like, I'm done. I'm not going to work with stuff I don't like. And so I think I love hearing those stories because that's how you're successful, is when you love what you do, you know, and you should never look at an animal and think, like, it always bothers me. Obviously I do a lot of ball pythons, but again, I you know, my love affair with ball pythons stems back to when I was 2 years old, you know, so I worked with ball pythons. I'll tell you guys a real quick story. Literally, I was buying ball pythons, and people were making fun of me for buying ball pythons. Literally, I'm not kidding.
Really?
Other breeders, I remember going out to dinner with Mark Bell, Pete Call, and a couple other people in Baltimore, Maryland, and the entire dinner, all they did was rib on me about buying ball pythons. You know, I mean, the whole time, they're just like, yeah, I want to go buy another ball python, right? So I was getting into these animals because I just loved them. I wasn't a prognosticator. I didn't know this market was going to explode like it did. I just got into it because I love the damn things, you know. And so it's, I think with carpet pythons or whatever your pleasure is with reptiles, that's what you should really be focusing on, is what do I like? Don't follow the trends. I always tell people the worst thing you can do as a reptile business is chase projects. You know, I mean, you know, don't chase after something because you think you're going to make a ton of money. If you love carpet pythons and you think you can make money, then go after carpet pythons. But don't work with carpet pythons because you think you can make money when you really want to work with sand boas. You know what I mean? It's like, work with sand boas and do your thing with sand boas. So that's really, I think, and I live by that. I literally live every day of my life by that advice.
That's awesome. So, like, what are some of the obstacles that someone starting a reptile business would have to overcome?
You know, I think there's really so many, you know. I mean, and there's more now than there probably ever was, you know. I mean, obviously, legislation is a huge one to consider, you know, local, you know, municipalities that don't allow, you know, reptile breeding in a facility or in your house. I mean, there's so many obstacles that used to not be there that are there now. And then beyond that, you know, it's just making your niche, you know what I mean? I think that with anything, you know, over time it gets a little bit harder to make your niche, you know, and to find a spot that you're going to shine in. You know, when there's a sea of people doing something, you know, how are you going to shine through the sea of people? And, you know, those are more difficult, but not insurmountable, you know? I mean, I think that the internet has leveled the playing field a lot, you know? I mean, you know, in the past, I think that, you know, the big breeders were kind of the big names, and it was really hard to dethrone them, you know. Now,
yeah.
You know, if you're a real internet-savvy person and, you know, you blog and you tweet and you Facebook and you have a real kick-ass website and you're involved in, you know, forums and communities like your guys, you know, I think at that point you can level the playing field a lot. And you know, but again, you know, I always tell people, try not to you know, you don't have to worry about competing with the quote-unquote big names or something like that. Just try to make your own thing happen. You know, I mean, I think that people as a whole in the reptile business are so tied up in making excuses why not to buy from someone else that they forget that what you really should be doing is convincing people to buy from you. You know what I mean?
Right.
I never try to make a sale on don't buy from someone else. I try to make a sale on, hey, I think you'd be better off buying from me. You know, not because the other guy's bad. It's
right.
Just that I'm gonna be as good as you possibly. Ooh, I got a quality animal at a good fair price with good service after the sale, and so I think that's one of the other things I always try to tell people is to don't get tied up into to bashing people or getting involved in internet wars and so on like that. But you know, I think that, you know, there, as much as I think it's more difficult in ways to become kind of successful breeding snakes nowadays, in some ways there's advantages that we didn't have when I was growing up in this business. You know, again, growing up in this business, it was all about word of mouth. You know, I mean, if you know,
right.
if people were talking bad about you, you weren't going very far. You know, now it's pretty amazing, and I know you guys probably, you know, and I certainly don't, you know, make it a habit of talking bad about people, so I don't mention names, but it's amazing to me some of the you know, I'm going to just come out and say rip-off artists that are in this business that have been in the business for 10 years, and they still thrive. I mean, people don't
they're still here, right? They have,
you know,
the worst stories imaginable on the forums, and they're still here. Yeah.
Yeah, and people still, well, yeah, but I bought that jungle carpet from them because they were $85 instead of $125, you know? And you go, yeah, but you got a coastal. You got a coastal carpet. And that was, you know, well, yeah,
that was the reason.
So how does that
work
out for you? Yeah, and I mean, but again, you know, I think there's, as much as there's, I think the major thing is, again, the legislation. You know, the fact that it's very much more difficult to do, you know, a reptile business in a lot of municipalities than there used to be. And I think we're always fighting and dealing with that. So that's the number one thing I think that concerns me about, like, the new people in the business.
Right. Now, you know, you bring up a good point about buying from you and not trying to badmouth convincing somebody not to buy from somebody else's. When I started putting my collection of carpet pythons together, my objective was to have the best of the best and then breed them and then, you know, mix those different genetics or whatever together and create even better and selectively
yep.
breed, and then my animals were going to speak for themselves. You know, of course, I'd have to do some, you know, PR and stuff like that to get my name out there, but, you know, the animals are what is going to speak for
yep.
me, you know, so...
Well, I think that's absolutely it. I mean, you know, I think that, you know, I always tell people in business it's pretty simple. You know, there's three things. There's price, quality, and service. The easiest thing to do in business is to cut your price, but it's
right.
not the best thing to do. You know, I mean, that's a very short-term view on business, you know. So really
right.
what I always have focused on is having a fair price, not high, not low, a fair price with the best quality I could have in really good service, you know. And like you said, if you can do those two things, you know, you're going to compete with anybody, you know, and you
right.
don't have to bash other people, and you don't have to start rumors about people, and you don't have to make other people look bad in order for you to shine. You know, that's what you need to do. And it sounds like you did a great thing. I mean, again, if your animals stand a cut above everybody else, people are going to come to you. And what's amazing, and I know you guys have probably seen this, is that when you get that reputation for having a cut above the rest, you know, you'll have a carpet python on your table for $200 and the guy next to you will have them for $150 and people will still buy yours for $200.
Right.
You know, because you have that reputation. Your service is great. You're a good person. You know the quality is going to be there. There's no, especially with carpet pythons, because we all know carpet pythons as babies, they're not the prettiest animal.
No.
You know?
Yeah, they are ugly as shit.
Yeah, I mean, you have to take the word for who you're buying from, that this is from a beautiful bloodline, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, because you could buy a jungle carpet that, you know, you think is going to, you know, yeah, this guy told me it was the beautifulest thing in the world, and it grows up and it's ugly as crap. But the next guy, you know, so I, you know, those are, you know, I mean, I think your words are perfect with that. You know, you get that reputation of having great stuff, and then you don't have to worry about what everyone else is doing. And I think that's kind of my point, is that I think that a lot of people in the reptile hobby spend so much time worrying about what their competitors are doing. I'll be honest with you. I'm friends with the vast majority of my competitors, and I have really high opinions of the vast majority of my competitors. But you know what? I never worry about what they're doing. You know what I mean?
Right.
I just don't.
Right.
There's never a time in my day that I go, oh, man, so-and-so produced this, this means that I'm not going to be able to sell my stuff. That's not something that ever comes to my mind. You know, when I hear a friend of mine produces something cool, I'm happy for him. I'm like, awesome, that's fantastic. You know, and I think that maybe the newer age, the internet age of the reptile business, I think too many people get tied up on the negative side of things and keep away from the positive. And that's quite frankly why I don't spend a whole lot of time on forums, in all honesty, is because there's so much negativity, you know, that I try to stay away from it, and I try to steer clear of it as much as I can.
Right. Now, how do you, and here's a question for you, is like promoting your business, you know, with social media and everything that's out there now, how important do you feel that that plays into your business? And how do you draw non-reptile people into the hobby from that?
Well, the one thing I will say is that anyone that isn't involved in social media is missing the boat in a big way. Now, I think that being said, there's many different ways to look at social media. I look at social media very unorthodox compared to most people in the reptile business. I look at it as very personal, very like, I'm going to let everyone into my life. You know what I mean? I'm going to tweet about movies I like. I'm going to tweet about where I'm going today. I'm going to tweet about silly thoughts that come into my head. That's not for everybody. You know what I mean? Anyone who follows me on Facebook knows that, you know, I hardly ever post a status update that doesn't have a question on it. You know what I mean? And it's normally silly stuff like, hey, can you become a zombie by having sex with zombies? You know,
that is something I think we need to answer, though.
Yeah, it is. That's a very serious question.
That is a very crucial question. Come on.
But my point is that, you know, I use social media in the sense that, you know, I mean, basically, to step back one more second, you know, when we started Snake Bites 4.5 years ago, one of the things I had a conversation with Lori when we were starting to go down this path was, you know, now you got to remember, for 18 years prior to starting Snake Bites, I was kind of a ghost in the business. You know, and what I mean by that is that, you know, I don't have an, you know, I mean, everyone has an ego. I mean, you know, but my ego is very small, I think. I think it still is. You know, I don't look at myself any better than anyone else. I just clean snake shit for a living. I always say that. And you know, but my point is that I never looked for affirmation in the community as like a quote unquote big breeder. For 18 years, I was kind of quietly going about my business. I hardly ever posted anywhere. I didn't have a website. I mean, or my website was very, you know, minuscule. I didn't post anywhere. I was just really quiet. And all of a sudden we're starting this like media thing, like, holy crap, man, we're going to have cameras and we're going to have videos. And although we didn't know where it was going back then, you know, one of the things I talked to Lori about, and this kind of relates to how I feel about social media, is I said, if we go down this path, this means our life is open, like an open book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everything about our life, you know, I mean, like, I'm going to do things, you know, I'm not going to keep it. Now, again, that social media strategy isn't for everybody, you know what I mean? Because it's very intrusive. I mean, you've got to live it, you know what I mean? Like, for the last 4.5 years, and probably more, even more so in the last 2 years, like, my life is always about sharing with everybody that follows me. I mean, everything I do, I share with everybody. You know, I mean, that's just the way I am. And I kind of feel like, for me, how it works for me is that by sharing my life, people get to know me, and then they feel more comfortable dealing with me. You know, I mean, that's my strategy. And again, I'm not like, oh, like a snake oil salesman or something like that, where I'm trying to sell it. I mean, this is true. This is true. You know, I mean, I the stuff I post and the stuff I tweet and the stuff I go through is all 100% reality. And it's, I love the interaction with everybody, you know, around the world. You know, I mean, the fact that that I can just interact with so many people, whether it be through YouTube or Twitter or Facebook or any other social media that I work on. It's fantastic, and I think that I will say this, it's a very hard strategy to keep up because you have to be committed to it. You have to be 24/7. Like first thing in the morning, I'm not kidding you guys. I wake up in the morning before I roll out of bed, I'm on Twitter. I'm checking my, my replies. I'm checking. I mean, I roll out of bed, and from the time I do that to the time I go to sleep, I'm thinking about Twitter. I'm sharing. Like, I open up a cage and I see a snake that's just like, wow, and I take a picture of it and tweet it. You know what I mean? It's like, so life is very different. That doesn't work for most people, honestly. I think it's too much for most people to handle to open up like that to people. But at the same time, I think that, you're really missing the boat if you're not Facebooking and you're not tweeting. Twitter's, I realize it's not that popular in the reptile business, but I'm telling you, it's a great form of social media. I love Twitter. It's my favorite form of social media is Twitter. And if you're not doing that, I think you're really missing the boat because you can share things so quickly with the world. Almost every day for the last month or so, in the morning, I'm tweeting a picture from my incubator room, of the new thing that's hatching out. And so literally, before anybody sees anything, even guys at my shop see it, the world needs to see it on my Twitter feed. And so social media is so huge. And I think, I think that as a reptile community, we're not using it is up to its par. I think we're way behind the curve. Because I follow a lot of other industries in social media, and I try to emulate them, quite frankly. I look at the people I think do social media correctly, and I try to emulate those people. And it's funny because I can only emulate them so much because the following isn't there yet. The Twitter, there's only so many people that are going to follow me on Twitter because only so many people that are into reptiles are on Twitter. Whereas I think there's other communities where, if you're, say, a foodie, someone that's into food, you could have 300,000 followers because anyone that's a culinary expert has a gazillion followers. Well, we just don't have that in the reptile business. But it'll come. And I think that anyone that's getting into the reptile business, part of their strategy should be, what is going to be my social media attack,
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that that's the key to grabbing, non-reptile people. It's like, because I know people from my family that follow my Facebook account and they see it and their friends see it and, they know me as the snake guy,
Yeah. Well, what's so amazing, and you're right, everything you do has to, it's funny you say that outside the reptile community because that's been my focus for the last 4 years is to get outside of I think that the thing that I think our industry does wrong, and I say this from USARC to reptile people to everything, if I have a complaint, is that we beat our own drum too much, what is, and again, I love USARC. I'm a huge supporter of USARC and I'm 100% behind them, but what do they do to get outside the reptile community and start, like when they want to do a campaign, they post on kingsnake.com, they post on this, they post on that. I'm all about, or like when someone wants to sell something or someone wants to do something, all we do is like, okay, I'm going to advertise in Reptiles Magazine and I'm going to post on this, Fauna Classifieds. And so we just keep rotating through the same group of people. And yeah, there's new people coming in, but it's not like, floods of people. So that's really what started my concept with snake bites, to be totally honest with you, was the whole idea was, how can I get outside of the reptile community? And I thought YouTube. That's the first thing I thought was YouTube, And now, of course, with Facebook and Twitter and so on like that, it's pretty much, I would be willing to say, honestly, probably 30% of my Twitter followers don't keep snakes. Don't even keep snakes. They just, they either follow our web show or they just follow my insanity, the way I post crazy shit all the time. And that's how it goes. But I'll give you an example. Our Facebook page, not the BHB Reptiles, but the Snake Bites Facebook page, the outreach, which is basically, okay, we have 15,000 people that like our Facebook page. It's all of their friends and their friends and blah, 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 blah. It's 6 million people. Is the outreach.
Wow.
Wow.
So like you said, when you post and your family sees it, and then their friends see your family's things and blah, 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 blah. I mean, think about that. 6 million people have the opportunity to view our Facebook page. You know, that's what our outreach
is. That's pretty intense.
So, yeah. Now
yeah,
we don't reach 6 million people. I'm saying the potential is there to reach 6 million people. And that, and I would be willing to bet you that probably 5.9 million of those people don't keep reptiles. You know, and so we're in the process and continuing to always figure out ways to encourage people to know. We're developing a video game right now, you know, where it's going to be, you know, snake related type video game, and our hopes are that it will be interestingly enough that hopefully people that aren't into reptiles will want to play the game. You know what I mean? And by them playing, there'll be some genetics issues behind it. There'll be some practical things of reptiles keeping behind it. And hopefully we'll just open the doors to where people will start going, well, what's this all about? You know? And
yeah.
And that's what we always are trying. We're continuously working on, you know, the next generation. And I always say, if I spent, you know, 50% of the time that I spent on working on trying to recruit people into our hobby, if I spent 50% of that time on my business, I would be 10 times more successful than I am. You know, but I feel, you know, I feel a calling to do it. You know what I mean? It's like, again, mm-hmm. that guy that was 18 years into the hobby and a ghost, all of a sudden, you know, changed his mentality. You know, I mean, I got out there and started doing the YouTube show and started doing, and I just liked it, you know, not because I needed an ego stroke or needed the affirmation from people to tell me how great I am, because trust me, you know, I get a lot of the opposite from doing what I do. I mean, the one thing I can tell you is when you start doing YouTube videos, you better have thick skin, because they're going to say the most nasty things about you. But that's just and not just the YouTube people, the reptile people will be happy to say nasty things about you too, you know. So, you know, those are things that you have to do. But my point is that, you know, it feels right. You know what I mean? It's like I enjoy doing it. I enjoy working on it. And you know, the other thing was is that, you know, hey, I'm not looking to be the leader of the hobby. I'm not looking at being the voice of the hobby. But I did, you know, say, you know, about, and this is quite honestly another reason why we started the show, was I looked around and said, man, there's just all this negative stuff about reptiles, you know, and
right.
Nobody was saying anything. Nobody was doing anything about it. And
right.
I thought to myself, I need to do something about this. And sometimes the saying I've always said is that sometimes the best politician is the guy that hates politics. You know, but he believes in what he believes. You know, he believes in what he believes in so much he's willing to sacrifice to stand up for what he believes in. And that's kind of like really the antithesis of what I do right now, is that I don't, you know, dude, I love doing all this stuff. I love, you know, producing the show. I found a love for being involved in production and being in front of a camera and doing it. I love all that. But the truth is, I wish I didn't have to do any of it. You know, I mean, honestly,
mm-hmm. Right.
You know, if I love snakes, if I just had to wake up in the morning and not have to return 200 emails and most of which are, you know, people that are just like, hey, I love your show or what, you know, which I appreciate every one of those messages. But my point is I return every one of those messages, too. You know, I don't just look at them. I return them.
Right.
And, you know, if I didn't have to wake up in the morning and do that.
Copy and paste stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, so my point is that if I just could do my job and not have to worry about all that, my life would be a lot better in a lot of different ways. But I believe in what I believe in. And do it, trust me, does that mean that I haven't made lots of mistakes? Of course I made. And I can tell you what, I'll continue to make mistakes. I have no doubt about it. But I have to believe, especially with the feedback that I see every single day, that the impact that we're trying to achieve is more positive than negative. And that's what keeps me focused on going forward in the future. But like you said, it is about outreach to new people and bringing new people in. And the best mm-hmm. thing, and again, you know, people don't see the messages and the emails I get every day. Literally, I'm not kidding you guys, every single day I get at least one and sometimes two, three, four people that say they came across our YouTube show a month ago, 2 months ago, 3 months ago, whatever it might be, and they're getting their first snake. You know, every single
awesome.
Day I get that.
That's
every
awesome.
Single day. And that drives me more than anything. More
yeah.
than anything. And I can tell you this much, 99.999% of those emails, they're not buying them from me, okay?
Yeah.
So I'm not benefiting from it personally. I know our hobby is benefiting, you know. So, and as you guys probably are aware, you know, my show is never a freaking infomercial. You know what I mean? I can say in the 4.5 years, I think one time we put BHB.com on BHBReptiles.com on the screen. One time in 4.5 years. I mean, as a matter of fact, I know a lot of people think I'm a complete moron for not promoting my show. You know, that's the other thing that, and I know, I'm sorry, guys, I go off on tangents like crazy.
No,
but, you know,
go for it.
It's pretty amazing how many times I get people that message me and go, "Do you sell snakes?" And I think to myself, like, what the hell do you guys think I do with all these snakes? You know, I love watching your show. Do you guys sell snakes? No, we just leave them all. We just have these as pets, you know. But I think that in a way that when I get those messages, I think, well, I'm doing my job then, because I'm not putting it out as an infomercial. I never wanted it to be an infomercial, and I won't ever turn it into an infomercial. And there are certainly times when I could probably use the business, you know, but I just choose not to.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, Brian, but again, something else that starting this show is kind of, you know, I got the ideas from Reptile Radio and from you with the snake bites, and I very rarely push my own website. I push Morelia Python Radio. And, you know, the reason is because I don't – the purpose of the show for me is not to – push my business. It's just to get more people into carpet pythons and Morelia, and, you know, just seeing that there's more to snake keeping than morphs. Don't get me wrong, I love morphs because I have all carpet python morphs, but, you know, I sometimes get nervous that, you know, when I first started out in the reptiles when I was younger, you know, I didn't even know what a morph was. You know, it was just about, you know, getting that next species of python, the next level. Like, you know, you start out with the ball python, and then maybe you'll move up to maybe a carpet python, and then you get a Burmese python, and, you know, it's like, and then you're eventually at the Boland's python. It's like, ooh, a Boland's python, ooh, a blackhead python, you know what I mean? It's like,
right.
You never see anything like that. But, you know, and that's kind of the whole purpose of this, is just to get people to understand that, you know, If nobody breeds those things or keeps those things, then they're going to be gone, you know?
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt about it. And I, you know, being around for a while, it does bother me, you know, the kind of streamlining of the industry that I see. And what I mean by that is that when you go to a reptile show right now, I love ball pythons, I love leopard geckos, I love corn snakes. But it seems like 99% of the tables are that. You know what
that
I mean?
Is it. Pretty much.
Yeah, and I was just talking about this the other day with a friend, where I remember the old Orlando shows or the very early Daytona shows, when you used to go and you used to see stuff. You'd see Malagasy brown boas, and you would see, you know, Venezuelan rainbows, and you'd see, like you said, the occasional Bolins on the table, or Black D. Albert's pythons, or, you know what I mean? Like, you just never knew what you were going to see at these shows. You would just walk around going, oh my gosh, I've only seen these in books or blah.
Yeah.
And now you just don't see that anymore. Never. And it's so disappointing. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love walking around and seeing the stuff I see. It's amazing. But it's just a shame that people, you know, the animals that people used to really love and the obscure stuff, it's just, you know, I mean, look at scrub pythons. Who the heck even works with scrub pythons, you know? They're incredible, beautiful, and might be one of the coolest snakes, I think, in the world. You know, I mean,
oh,
I love scrub
gorgeous
pythons.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they're just amazing. And I just sit back. I mean, I remember going down to Eugene Bassett's and seeing his big king horn eye. I mean, this 15-foot monster. And I was just like, oh, my God. Gosh, it is one of the coolest animals I've ever seen. And I can't remember the last time I've seen a scrub on a table.
Yeah.
You know, so it is disappointing. But I will say this, guys. I've seen a transition back towards the interest of those projects. Now, I think it's going to take a while to get there. But take, for instance, Bismarck ring pythons, you know. I mean, these were animals when I was breeding. I don't have any anymore, unfortunately. I wish I did. But when I was breeding, I was producing 100, 150 Bismarcks a year. I was having a hard time wholesaling them for $75 and retailing for 100, 100 and a quarter, you know, retail. And now, like you can't find them for under $1,500 a pair. And people that do have them have a waiting list, you know?
Yeah.
And to me, that's inspiring. Like, okay, we're starting to get back there. And I'm starting to see even like colubrids, as a matter of fact. You know, the colubrid market has been pretty crap for the last 5 or 6 years. I'm not going to even, you know, sugarcoat
it. It has been.
But this year, I have gotten more interest in colubrids than I probably have had in the last 5 or 6 years. I mean, like, literally, I have pre-orders on colubrids like I haven't had in 7 or 8 years. I'm not kidding you.
Hmm.
So
wow,
people are getting back, like they're cycling back to other things. And that doesn't mean that ball pythons aren't going to be successful and corn snakes and leopard geckos aren't going to be successful and bearded dragons, because those they certainly will, because those are still the mainstay in the pet trade. But I think that people are starting to step up and saying, you know, I want, like you were just mentioning, I'm ready
right.
for the next challenge. I'm ready for the next challenge.
Yeah.
Let's work our way to something really, truly exotic. And I think we're going to see maybe 4 or 5 years from now, you know, people are going to be really doing well with those projects.
That is cool. And I'm glad you mentioned the black D'Alberts, because right now I'm working with gold and black D'Alberts. And
nice.
Gold, I can throw a rock and hit 20 of them. Black, good luck finding it. It is so hard to find them right now. And a couple of years ago, my friends and I had several of them, and you could get them easy for $1.50. Now, good luck, and it's killer. And I love having, like, I have the extensive, you know, I have the carpets, but then I have some Macs, I have the D'Alberts, I got the Malukins, I have the Spotteds, I have, you know, water pythons. I have these things that I'm like, okay, these things are awesome, and they're here for me. And I'm going to breed them and put them on my table because no one ever sees them. And I want to be that kind of thing where it's still here. I don't want it to go away. I'm doing my part to make sure it stays here. So I'm glad you think it's going back that way.
Oh, I think it is. I mean, I think that, you know, as you're producing, you're going to see a swelling of people that are interested in buying that stuff. You know, I really, really do. And that is, you know, Black D'Alberts is such a prime example of an animal that, like, you just, I mean, they were one of the coolest snakes. And I remember Mark Bell produced, he used to produce every year, you know, he had like one pair. And I remember one of the guys that worked for him was like, listen, you know, his adult female just died. And he had like, you know, 6 or 7 baby, you know, well started, you know, Black D'Alberts. And the guy Keith came up to me and he's like, dude, you really need to buy some of these. He goes, because these may be the last ones, period. Like, like there might not be any more. And fortunately, there were some more out there. But my point is that, those are, you know, and we've seen it with mutations with certain snakes, like certain bull snake mutations and certain, like another good example is like black variable kings, you know, ferae. Black ferae used to be everywhere. Like, I mean, like you were almost like, okay, I'll buy an orange ferae for $85, and that black one, I don't even want to pay you 20 for that one, you know? And now, like, I haven't seen a black ferae for 5 years. I don't even know if they're in existence anymore. They might just be gone. Like, you know, people might just, like, you know, people were working to not produce them because they weren't popular. And now, like I said, it's been 5 years. I would love somebody to call me up and say, hey, I've got some black ferae, you know, because I think they're just gone. I think they're done until, you know, maybe someone pops up randomly in a collection again with them. And that's just one of many, many animals that used to be very prevalent, even from a mutation standpoint, that is basically gone now. And that's why we've had always had a very eclectic collection of things, you know, where we, you know, like you said, I have maglots, I have, you know, crebos, I have, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff that like people look and go, why do you have that? And I'm like, because I like it.
Cool.
You know, and
I
don't.
Why.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't care that you don't like it, and I don't care that 99% of people don't ever want it. You know, Lori, it drives Lori crazy. My wife. You know, that I have these animals that we produce and literally can hardly give away, you know?
Yeah.
We produce them. I mean, like, there are some things, like, she won't let me breed. She's like, you better not put them together this year because we have 3 years' worth of offspring, you know? We have only 3 years of babies. And she's like, we got to get rid of them. I'm like, no, there's no way we're getting rid of these. And some of those projects have now come back around. You know, that's what's so funny was, like, there was a few of those projects, like black rat snakes were a good example. For a couple years, you could hardly give a licorice stick black. I mean, literally, I was wholesaling for like $12 and still having people turn me down. You know, like $12. No, I don't want those things. Now all of a sudden they're coming back where people are all of a sudden buying them for $50, $60. And so it's nice to see, like I said, that I think some of the streamlining that was like, I want ball pythons and corn snakes and bearded and leopards, I think some of that is starting to broaden out and people are looking into some other areas. And I think that that's really, ultimately, that's very healthy for our hobby.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well,
I know the, just one more thing I'll mention on that is that, you know, I have some pretty cool carpet python morphs and everything, but I think the thing that every time I go into my reptile room that I look at is my Halmahera scrub. It's one of my favorite snakes that
it's
I have,
awesome.
You know, it's so cool. I just love that.
They are,
you know,
just,
other
yeah,
people would
awesome.
Probably look at it and say, oh man, that thing is ugly, but that's a cool snake.
Yeah,
you know?
I can't imagine anyone saying that's ugly though, but I mean, I'm not, scrubs aren't for everybody, but I don't think anyone thinks they're ugly. They're just beautiful animals.
Oh yeah. I love mine. All of them. Great colors, big contrast, bad attitudes. But
I love it. I love those attitudes, man. Those are the best.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
All right.
Okay.
So, well, I minimized as we were speaking because I was just not paying attention to where we were. Because I'm like, all right, snake talk. Yeah. All right. Brian, what size is your collection? Because I know every once in a while in Snake Bites, you guys start walking around the camera, and it looks like your facility is huge, and you have, like, millions of animals, and I could probably get lost, but, like, I know you probably know each bin and where everything is, like, drop of a hat. So how big is the collection you're working with?
Well, you know, it of course it always varies because we're always buying and selling stuff. You know, I mean, not so much buying and selling so much as is buying new stuff to keep and selling stuff that we're producing and stuff like that. I would say, you know, like on the downside of the year when things are light, like we've sold off a lot of our last year's babies, but we're not producing this year's babies yet. And so like that, we're probably at about 25,000 snakes.
Wow.
You know, when we're at the peak of our season where, you know, we're up to our ears in hatchlings, you know, we probably push close to 50,000 animals, you know, but this is pretty short period that we're at that number. You know, I'd say we're typically between 25 and 30,000 snakes. I would say that would be the average over the course of the year. Like I said, with some peaks of up to 50 and some, you know, downsides of 25, you know, but it's a lot of mouths to feed. There's no doubt about that.
Wow. That's cool. It's a lot of animals, a lot of mouths to feed.
It really is, you know, and there's a lot of diversity in there. You know, that's the thing that, you know, I sometimes don't show enough on the show and people don't realize is that how much stuff we work with that's very eclectic, you know, that just we have like one pair of or whatever. So there's a lot of varieties. I don't know how many species or color morphs or whatever it is, but it's a lot. I mean, it's, you know, I always say, like, I'm not that guy that has, you know, okay, I have, you know, 250 adult albino corn snakes. You know, I'm not that guy, you know. I mean, I have, like, you know, like, you know, I have, like, 10 albino corn snakes, but then I have 10 snow corns, and I have 10 ghost corns, and I have 10 blood reds, and I have this, and that.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of, my groups are more like 10 or 12 of this, and then 10 or 12 of that, 10 or 12, and it just adds up, because I know people that have these huge collections of, you know, 2,000 colubrids, but there's only 5 different morphs that they produce, or 15 different morphs that they produce, you know. I'm not that guy. I'm not, you know, I get bored. I don't get bored. I shouldn't say get bored, but I want the excitement of hatching all kinds of different stuff.
Something,
you know?
Different, yeah.
Yeah.
Something.
Yeah.
You don't want the same thing coming out of the egg every time.
I don't want to produce.
Come on.
Yeah. I don't want to produce widgets. You know, I mean, that's what I always tell people. You know, I mean, I don't want to produce stuff that's just like, I don't care what that is. That's $10. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't want.
Right.
And again, that goes back to maybe me not being the best business person, because, you know, maybe that $10 guy is making money very, very consistently. You know, whereas I'm more like out there and sometimes, you know, if let's say I produce, you know, 8 to 10,000 corn snakes a year, which is about what I normally produce, you know, I might be better off to have 80% of those be generic corns, you know, normals, albinos, blacks, you know, snows and stuff like that, because those are what really sell. you know, in the meantime, I've got, you know, 2,000 corn snakes sitting on the shelf that are, you know, $35 to $100, and they're trickling out, you know, one here, one there, and it takes an awful long time to sell them. But that's just the way I've always run my collection, and that's the way I probably always will.
Awesome. Now, I've seen some episodes of Snake Bites where you guys are talking about your favorite kind of snakes, and, you know, every once in a while you pull out the Jags that you have. So what type of carpet pythons are you working with currently?
Well, you know, I wish I had a lot more. You know, I was really more...
I can fix that for you.
Yeah, I know, and I really do need that. I'm not even joking. I need to get back on the cutting edge of Jags, or carpets, I should say. You know, I mean, I've got Jags, I've got Granites, I've got some really nice jungles. I've got, you know, Brettles and the you know, I hasten to say hypo Brettles. I don't know what they should actually be called, but I've got those, and you know, and then some just really nice coastal stuff, you know, like some tri stripe stuff and some other things like that. But I don't have nearly the like cutting edge carpet stuff that I'd like to have. You know, I mean, I used to, ironically enough, way back, I think we were the second or third people in the country to produce jungle carpets. So back then I was like a carpet python guy. You know, this is when I was a kid, like 19, 20 years old. And, as a matter of fact, there was a magazine called Captive Breeding Magazine that had the cover story was on our jungle carpet. Cause we were like, It was like me and, you know, was it Larry Reed or whatever, we're like the only two guys that year that produced jungle carpets in the entire country.
Wow,
you know,
awesome.
So I was really, and I think that, you know, within a couple years of then, I was producing probably about 500 carpet pythons a year, different, you know, back then there wasn't nearly what there is now, but, you know, for then I was kind of cutting edge, you know, and then somehow I just lost it. And I think that what really happened was, I was renting a building at the time that was not really big, and I kind of downsized out of Burmese pythons, Dumerils, boas, common boa constrictors, carpet pythons, all the things that I really, you know, all that stuff that takes 3-foot by 3-foot cages or something, you know what I mean? I could no longer fit those animals, and I kept some of all of them, but I went from having pretty good numbers where I might have had, you know, 70 or 80 adult carpet pythons to having, you know, 15 carpet pythons or 20 carpet pythons. And I never really grew it back. Like, I probably right now, total carpet python-wise, have maybe, you know, 60 or 70 carpets. You know, and I never really grew it past that again, you know. But I've targeted them, really, ironically enough, the last 3 or 4 years I've been like, my one goal is to just get a bunch of really cool carpet pythons this year. And it's just never has happened. And I don't know why. I mean, I can't really put my finger on it. There's always been something else that's come up that's made me, you know, spend my time, money, energy, whatever you might want to say, towards another project for whatever reason. But so the only really cutting edge thing that I have, I feel, is those hypo freckly type, you know, Brettles, which unfortunately I'm still a little ways away from figuring out. I had two males this year, and I've got a female that's only a 2-year-old, so she wasn't big enough to breed. She, you know, hopefully she'll go next year for me. And they, quite honestly, they just didn't breed. I mean, I like put them in with females, and they just sat there like a bump on the log. And I tried everything I could do to get them to go, and I tried all my tricks of the trade, and they didn't do anything. So hopefully next year.
All the carpet breeders are having problems this year. So from what I hear, is everyone's having a bad year except for Eric and his freshman fire right here, and it makes me hate him. So
that's awesome. But like you said, next year will be my year. You know, I mean, next year I'll be able to do whatever. The thing that's going to be interesting is that, you know, those animals kind of spontaneously popped out of a clutch of Brettles that I had. And they're really different looking. Like you have to really see them in person to understand what they are. And I don't like to call them hypos because the hypos from Australia are very different.
Yes.
They look more like the freckled stuff that I've seen in Australia. But they're not exactly like that either. They're different from that. And when people see them in person, come see them, there's some, you know, I have a crazy theory that I'll share with you guys, and you guys will laugh at me because maybe I'm becoming like Dr. Frankenstein over here, but you know what they remind me of? they remind me of yellow-belly ball pythons. And what I mean by that is that they don't have any black freckles on their belly. They have like a really weird granited side pattern, and their pattern goes up. The flames go up. So their bellies look just like yellow-belly ball pythons. That's what they look like. And we all know when you breed two yellow bellies together, you get white snakes. So I'm here hoping that maybe I get lucky and it is a co-dominant type of thing that cropped up. Maybe I had a really low-quality one that I didn't realize was, and that was the father, blah, blah, blah. The problem was is I literally don't even know who the father – I know who the mother is, but I don't know who the father is because I was cycling, like, seven males through these females. And so I don't know what that pairing is to do it again, you know, to find out is this recessive or is this a spontaneous codominant mutation and it's pops. I don't know, you know, but I guess in my wildest dreams I'm sitting there going, oh, please, if I breed them together, let's pop out a white one. But I realize that you know, I'm going to keep living the dream, okay? Just don't break my bubble.
No, please. I hope it works because that would just be the next cool thing to shoot out. Definitely be awesome.
You know, it's funny you say that the thing with the yellow belly ball python. I forget who I was talking to. It might have been you, Owen, but we were talking about the fact that carpet pythons are so variable. And one of the things I learned from ball python breeders is that they have all these little dinker projects, and you look at it, and like I would probably look at it and say, that looks like a normal ball python.
Ball python.
And, you know, but the ball python breeders are like, no, man, there's something special about the way that this is. And the next thing you know, they breed it together, and now, you know, it's like, wow,
the silver,
where the hell
black,
did that come
crazy
from?
Ball python. Yeah.
You know?
What the hell?
Yeah. And I think carpet breeders often. They don't realize that, and I think that a lot of things go like untapped, you know, because they're not paying attention to what's going on. And I think I'm kind of with you on that boat with, you know, comparing it to the yellow belly ball python. So
yeah, I think with ball pythons, you know, some of the most subtle mutations are, you know, developed. Projects are producing some of the most incredible mutations, and I think that was the thing that early on a lot of us missed the boat on with ball pythons was that, you know, we weren't holding on to those subtleties, and some of the guys that were like really picking, like Amir down at the, you know, yellowbellyballpython.com down in Florida was a perfect example of like, you know, picking out really subtle mutations. I mean, like things I remember him showing me things, and I'm going, dude, that's just a freaking polymorphic ball python, you know? And then 2 years later, he's popping out something. I'm going, what? Where the hell did that come from? Remember that snake I showed you that, you know, I bought for $10 and you said I was an idiot? And I'm like, oh, my gosh.
Damn it.
So, yeah, those are some of the things that I try to now, you know, think about when I'm looking at other animals and saying, like, is there some subtleties that might potentially – and, hey, it's always a crapshoot, you know? I mean, I think that there's no doubt that this hypo freckly, whatever the heck you want to call them, brettles, will be genetic. No, now, will there be – let me put it this way. If all you can do is produce more of them, they're going to be an interesting animal, but they're not going to be big money. You know what I mean? It's going to be something that's like, okay, these are cool. I wouldn't mind buying these because they're really pretty. Because they are prettier than normal brettles. They really are. But they're not going to be a $5,000 snake. You know what I mean?
Right.
Whereas if there's another layer to the mutation, then, it, you know, game on. You know, it'll just be ridiculous.
Right.
Yeah.
That's cool.
That is excellent. So, like, with your collection, how do you manage such a large collection?
You know, it's really about, you know, it's like you said, it's about management, you know. Number one, you have to have a great crew of people, and I really do. You know, not only are they crazy and do crazy stuff on snake bites, but they're really great people. I mean, right now I have by far the best crew that I've ever had in the last 20 years of doing this. You know, they're not perfect, but neither am I. But it's about systems. You know, it's about, you know, doing a routine that makes sense, you know. And it's about when you manage a large collection, it's about little subtle things that make huge differences. Like, for instance, if you're going to do a row of waters, you know, and there's 5,000 baby snakes, it makes more sense to open a cage take the water out and throw a pinky in and close the cage. And then tomorrow go back, check your to see if it ate the pinky, put the new water in. So now you only open the cage twice to do two tasks, whereas if you did it the other way, you'd have to open up four times, you know? And so a lot of systems like that, you know what I mean? You get into routines where you know exactly what you're supposed to do, how you're supposed to do it, and you go through your systems. And so it's about, making great operational procedures and really managing things really well. And then, of course, you have to have the crew that can implement things that you tell them to, because it's impossible for a guy like me to open up every cage every week. I can't do it. You know, I have to rely on my crew. And although I'm involved in a lot of stuff that goes on in the shop, there are certain areas that I have very little to do with, and I have to continue to keep it that way. So it's about, and trust me, if there's a downside to having a big collection, occasionally somebody that maybe was a good employee becomes a bad employee, or someone that you think is a good employee turns out to not be a good employee, and those are the things that hurt. And trust me, I've been destroyed a couple times by some of the stuff that I've found in my collection, and that's the one thing that probably disheartens me more than anything. And I'm not even going to lie to you. There's been a number of times over the last several years where I've almost downsized tremendously because I've found animals not being cared for at the level that I personally can handle because of someone I was relying on doing it, and them just not doing their job properly. It's crushing. It's crushing when that happens. But fortunately, knock on wood, right now we're in really good shape. Everyone that works with me cares tremendously. I had half my crew work yesterday on Memorial Day, not because I asked them to, but because they wanted to. We're doing some pretty major renovations as far as like moving stuff around, and they just wanted to get it done. They're just like, hey, do you mind if we come in tomorrow and do this? And I was like, well, hey, I'm going to be here. I'm working every day, So we ended up spending, 10 hours at the shop yesterday on the holiday. That's special when you have crew like that.
Awesome. Definitely. We do see your crew's antics on snake bites, and by far my favorite is you guys cooking up slug eggs and eating them, and I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe they did that. So it's definitely good you got a crew that will do that with you.
I tell you, it's not as bad as you think. I mean, it really isn't. they were surprising. The texture was the problem, not the taste. The taste was not that different than a chicken egg. I mean, so shockingly, it was. But the texture was very bizarre, And the aftertaste stuck with you for a long time. I mean, like we always film about
snake
3 weeks. What's that?
You're tasting snake egg for a while.
Yeah, well, we film 3 weeks in advance, typically, most likely. And I don't normally see the end product because I have an editor that works with me on it, and he's been with me since early on. So he has a really good idea of what I want. And as a matter of fact, probably 9 out of 10 shows, I never even ask him to revise it. I'm just like, dude, that's perfect. I mean, that's exactly what I wanted you to do. You're right on. So a lot of times I don't see the show till a day or two after or before I launch it. So there's like 2.5 weeks, and I can tell you that snake egg one, when I saw the video 2.5, almost 3 weeks later, I could taste the egg. just watching the video made me taste it. I mean, it was something that I don't think I'll do again. But the crew does a lot of crazy stuff. But in reality, the guys are. They're crazy. I'm not gonna lie to you. I mean, sometimes things are more crazy at the shop when cameras aren't rolling than when they are. As a matter of fact, the majority of the time, things are more crazy when cameras are rolling or not rolling. As a matter of fact, it was weird because when we just shot some TV stuff recently, the first day the production crew was there, everyone was on like their best behavior. And it was the weirdest thing because I was walking around my shop and like it was quiet. You know what I mean? There was like nothing going on. And here's this production crew that, I've just met, and there's this, it's a relatively big deal that these guys are out. And I'm thinking to myself, these guys must think, like, why did we come out here? There's like nothing happening in this place. And unfortunately, within 2 or 3 hours, the guys loosened up and became themselves. And by the end of the day, we had captured some just really ridiculous footage of you know, interesting, you know, things that happened throughout the day. But yeah, no, they're typically, you know, yeah, they're usually out there, but they're great guys. You know what I mean? They can screw around, they can do all kinds of different stuff, but in the end, they understand. And they know that about me. Like I'm the type of boss that, hey, I don't care if you're screwing around, listening to music, doing, you know, yelling at each other, doing whatever, as long as at the end of the day, everything you're supposed to get done is done, you know? And that's all I really care about, you know? And so the environment there is normally, not always, there's days where, you know, the environment isn't good at my shop, but probably 9 out of 10 days, if not more, the environment is just really fun. You know, I mean, everyone's in a good mood. And it's just good times.
Cool. Now, what has been your biggest success as a snake breeder, and what has been like your the one thing that's kind of stuck in your mind is like, you know, oh God, I really messed up on that one or failed on that one.
You know, I think you know, it's always hard to say like what the biggest successes are. You know, I mean, obviously there was a couple things that you know, really three things that really uber stuck out that defined my business, I always say. You know, and the first one was albino Honduran milk snakes. You know, we brought the very first albino Honduran milk snakes into the country from Germany. And that really is what put me on the map, you know, way back in the day. And then shortly thereafter, you know, I really developed albino hognose snakes. You know, I was the second guy in that project. And, you know, I really worked hard at developing it. So hognose, again, going back to the day when people didn't care about hognose, you know, they thought they were stupid. I was working hard on, you know, I'm buying as much as I could and really developing the project. So that really helped me out tremendously. And then, of course, the big thing was the ball python movement, and in particular the pinstripe ball python. You know, that without the pinstripe ball python, my collection wouldn't be anything like it is today. You know what I mean? So those were the three kind of successful stories that I had. You know, there's been so many failures. You know, I'm not even kidding. You know, I've had tons of failures, and I think anyone that's been in the reptile business knows, or hobby for that matter, knows that, you know, with every success there's a failure. And that's what I always say when like a new timer comes up, like maybe, you know, Eric is coming in and having one of his tremendous years, I always say, you know, you'll come back down to earth. You know what I mean? It's like, I mean, I hope you don't. You know, I hope you have great year after great year after great year. But the fact
that you will come back to earth. Yeah.
Yeah, you will. I mean, it's just the way it is. And I always think it's funny that, especially with ball pythons, that, you know, they'll be kind of a new quote unquote hot shot that comes into the market. And, you know, he invests the money and he just cranks the first year's production. He cranks the second year production. He cranks the third year production. And he's just like the anointed golden child. And his ego, you know, the egos will just grow to unbelievable level. And I always just sit back and go, his day's coming. Don't worry. You know, I'm not even worried about it. And you know, within a year or two, bam, you know, he has a normal year. You know, like everyone else is having. And like, what happened? You know, why did I have? And they have such a hard time realizing that, you know, that's just the way snakes are. So with every success, you have a failure. With every failure, you have a success. And certainly, you know, those things, you know, as long as you don't let your failures define who you are, you can pretty much get past any of them.
Awesome.
It's funny, Brian, you say that about the thing with the failure. It's like, this is my first year really breeding, and for whatever reason, when we started the show, I got dubbed the maternal incubation guy, and Owen got dubbed the artificial incubation guy. So, you know, here I am, and I'm planning. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go maternal incubation. Everything's going to be great. The mom is the best, blah, blah, blah. First clutch on the ground, Irian Jaya's. There it is. Everything goes smooth as could be, right? Next clutch comes along, Zebra Jag, the Red Tiger. You know, this is the big one. This is the big clutch, you know. And sure enough, 4 of the eggs are outside of the coils. And where do I have to take them? Because my biggest failure this year is that I didn't have my incubator ready. So I had to run them over to Owen's house and stick them in his incubator because, you know, I'm like, oh, God,
this is working.
Yep.
What a loser.
Yeah, no, it's that's part of it, you know, and you learn and you get humbled by those type of things. And
Thank God that happened.
I'll be honest, guys, I think it's amazing when a reptile breeder has an ego, because to me, this business is about the humbling, most humbling business you could ever be in, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it really is. Just when you think you have something figured out, you know, a living animal will throw a loop to your system. So I always say that I just don't understand when I see somebody, you know, that has some kind of like rock star mentality when you're just breeding snakes. And you know, ultimately, like I said, it always comes, you know, people always come down to the pack these are living animals. They're never going to, you know, I used to always say, you know, the problem with breeding snakes is that they don't read the same books that I read, you know, because the books I read say, you know, you put them together and you have eggs this many days later and they hatch out and you're all happy. And
everyone's
those bastards
good, right?
Don't, yeah, those bastards don't read the same books because they go, no, I'm not going to do that. And but that's what makes it fun too.
Yeah, absolutely. So as far as the carpet, I mean, you have your pulse on pretty much the whole reptile business. I mean, you're, as far as snakes goes, you have your hands in a lot of different projects. Do you see any increase in the interest of carpet pythons when you're at shows or people talking to you? Or?
Yeah, I think I think it is. Yeah, I absolutely think it is. You know, I think it's been kind of an upswing for the last 4 or 5 years, in all honesty. And as more and more interesting animals are being produced, whether it's through line bred traits or recessive traits or codominant traits, I think that's going to just continue. You know, and I think that carpet pythons are going to continue to grow in popularity, even if they're just on the path that they're going now. But I think that they're almost like one mutation away from being like huge, you know? And I don't know
right.
what that mutation is. I'm just saying, like, one thing, like, in all honesty, I think the albino could have been that morph, but I think it was stained by so much potential negativity that it never made the impact that I think it could have made, you know? I think mm-hmm. that if the albino carpets would have came in 100% legitimately, and that there was no question about the legality, I think that the carpet python mutation or the carpet python industry or market would be bigger than it is right now even. You know, I really do believe it would be. But I think that there was so much like, you know, are these things legal, are they not legal, that it really bittered people about them, you know? And I think now most of that is behind, but it's already too late, you know what I mean? So I think that there might be, you know, if there's one more, like, jump starter morph, you know, I mean, I don't know if a piebald came out, a leucistic came out, a freaking, you know, who knows? I mean, some of the, you know, if the super zebra stuff keeps happening and you guys could, you know, produce a banana yellow one, you know, I mean, these are things I think that, you know, when people see some of this stuff, they're going to, you know, because I think the thing is with me as a carpet python guy, and maybe you guys as well, is we like these, like, subtle things that like me and you guys look at and go, oh my gosh, is that beautiful? But you got to remember the masses, when you get into a massive market, it's about shock value. It's about holy crap value. And so I think the carpets are growing and are going to continue to go on the uptrend. But I think that if one mutation pops up in someone's collection that is just like breathtaking, then game over. I mean, it's just going to be crazy, and it's going to just, because as soon as people start opening up to what they are, you know, then people will start seeing the beauty in the other mutations that we already see, you know. And again, I think that if there's a downside to the carpet python stuff, it's really twofold. You know, babies can be somewhat finicky, although they always eat. You know, just sometimes they don't eat as quickly as we'd like. You know, they're not one of those animals that hatches out. You throw a fuzzy in there and they pound it. And that's frustrating. I know when I was producing a lot of carpets, it was really frustrating that I would have carpets that were eating fine for me and I would ship and they just wouldn't eat for them. As a matter of fact, the very common thing that was happening to us that used to be funny as heck is that we would send off a carpet python, a jungle carpet, let's say, that's eaten 10 times. And they get to a guy, and they just wouldn't eat. I mean, the guys, you know, he had the setup was perfect, this was perfect, all this stuff, wouldn't eat, and then all of a sudden, you know, he'd ship it back to me, and the next day he'd eat for me. You know, yeah. Like, what the heck? So carpets are a little bit tricky when it comes to that type of stuff. And then, like I said, you know, I alluded to earlier, is the fact that, you know, they don't hatch out beautiful, they turn beautiful. you know. Mm-hmm. And that's something that people have to, you know, what has to happen is people have to be educated on what things are going to look like as opposed to what they look like. You know, like ball pythons, for instance, look beautiful right out of the egg. And sometimes mm-hmm. get uglier as they get bigger, you know. So their peak is at 300 grams, let's say. Like, that's where they're going to be beautiful. Whereas carpets, you know, they're like little ugly ducklings that are going to turn into beautiful swans. But, yeah. But you know, until you educate people and people go, well, what is this all about? And that's why I think it's on a steady growth, and I think that there's really positive things in the future regardless. But, man, I'm telling you, one mutation pops up that opens everybody's eyes, and it's going to be ridiculous. Because right now, you guys know, there's a lot of cool stuff in carpet pythons. A lot.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. so.
I think it's going to be the albino super zebra jag. It's going to be an all-orange snake.
Yeah, could you imagine that? I mean, yeah. And that's what I'm saying. That's what it's going to take. It's just one of those type of things. You know, you get a solid orange, you know, snake and someone shows up to Daytona or, you know, San Diego or wherever they are with a freaking 6-foot, you know, orange snake. I mean, people are going to be like, what the hell? And then the buzz gets out and then bam, it's just, you know, it'll just be like, you know, you won't be able to produce enough to meet the demand, you know. Because I will say this, you know, ball python money is moving away from ball pythons to some extent. It's still, you know, ball python money is still popular in ball pythons, but it is starting to move away. And people are looking in some other areas, like, hey, where else can I stick this money? You know,
right.
So the money is there. It's just waiting to pour into that market, I think.
Cool.
Awesome.
Now, with the whole morph thing, and there are some carpet python projects that don't exist yet, and your similar experience with ball pythons creating new combos, like, how do you go about pricing something like that? What do you take into account? Does it matter if it's recessive or if it's codom? Like, what do you run through in your head when you're coming up with what is this worth?
You know, it's always tough because I think every animal is different, you know, but what I try to do is you know, think of similarities. You know what I mean? If I say, okay, well, this guy sold this for $2,500 and this one is similar, but I think it's a little bit better or a little bit harder to get, I'm going to go $3,500. Or if I think, oh, well, you know, that one's $25 and this one's kind of easier to get, there's more common, you know, maybe I go $2,000. So I always look at market similarities. The other thing is that sometimes, and I think sometimes people make this mistake by going too cheap on their animals. When you have a new project, a new mutation, something that's relatively, you know, groundbreaking, sometimes if you go too cheap, people look past it, you know. So sometimes you've got to put a value on an animal that is high enough for people to really take a look and you know, look at it and go, wow, you know. And I'll give you a perfect example. Like, a good friend of mine produced red stripe ball pythons, which is a new codominant mutation, and he put them out for $5,000 right out the chute. And I really believe if he would have stuck them at $10,000, they would have sold better. You know,
wow.
And it seems weird because at $5,000, he's like, yeah, but they're not selling really well at $5,000. And I said, I think because you came in too cheap. You know, you made them look too cheap. I think that if people would have thought they were an investment at $10,000, you would have had a line of people buying them.
Right.
So that's the other thing to consider is sometimes you don't want to devalue a project before, you know, it needs to be. You know, I mean, you know,
mm-hmm.
people, you know, you got to remember when a snake is over $250 or $300 or $400, whatever that price point is, it's no longer a pet. It's an investment, you know.
Yeah.
And so no one wants to buy a snake that's a bad investment or not a great investment. So that's the other thing to take into account. And I think that some of the carpet python people have done a really good job of pricing their animals accordingly, you know, making them value, you know. And like I said, even with the albino stuff, I think that if they would have came under different circumstances, I think they would have held their value for a lot longer. Because I think when they first came in, they were probably valued at the right price, you know. But you know, just you know, they came down a little bit too quick.
Uh-huh.
Right.
All right. Makes some sense. Now, Brian, it's back to another episode of Snake Bites. You guys were in Australia
mm-hmm.
for a few episodes, which is, first off, makes me exceedingly jealous of you. and so can you tell us a little say?
Yeah, I've been there a couple times. I'll be back in November again. It's great down there. I mean, you know, obviously, I think as any reptile person, you would, you know, gosh, how would you not want to hang out in Australia? You know, it's got all the cool animals. It's got cool people. It's just a great place. And fortunately, you know, my third trip this November will be to Brisbane mainly, although I don't know where I'm going to end up after Brisbane. But the first time I went, I really hung out in the Sydney area, you know, in North Sydney, up towards Gold Coast a little bit. And it was great. You know, I mean, I got a chance to, you know, see Taronga Zoo and go up to John Weigel's place, you know, the reptile ranch up there, and see a bunch of private collections. And I mean, it was just really an amazing experience. And that's really when we filmed all the stuff we did, you know, I mean, feeding the crocs and milking tiger and taipan snakes and you know, got a chance to see the, you know, jet black carpet python of John Weigel, which was probably one of the highlights of the trip for me. You know, it was just a great time. The last time I was there, I spent the whole time filming a documentary that we're working on trying to get ready for release sometime later this year, up in Darwin. And I was able to, you know, do a lot of stuff in the wild this time. You know, I mean, you know, actually, you know, we collected a wild carpet python, which was really, you know, probably one of the coolest things that I've ever done, being that I've been a carpet python enthusiast for 20 plus years. To actually see one in the wild was beyond amazing.
That's awesome.
You know, yeah, because we really missed out. You know, I went herping down in Sydney the time before, the Sydney area, and we went to areas that were very known for diamond pythons. And we went out just kind of what I felt was the perfect day. It was about 70 degrees, sunny. I mean, it was just like kind of the – I mean, like it was one of those situations where, you know, I went out with a zookeeper, and he was like, yeah, I've caught many, many diamond pythons in this area. They're really prevalent. And it was kind of those things that you're walking around on these rocks, and you're just thinking like every second you're going to turn – and there's going to be a diamond python. You know what I mean? It's like,
right.
You just were sure of it. And unfortunately, the only thing we caught that whole day was a red-bellied black snake. And, you know, which was still cool in itself, don't get me wrong. But you know, it certainly wasn't a diamond python.
Not a diamond python, yeah. Come
no,
on.
So when I got up to Darwin, it was a really different situation. You know, I mean, there were, you know, we saw olive pythons up there. We saw, you know, some water pythons. We saw, you know, like I said, carpet pythons, and, you know, so it was a really great time up there, and like I said, we filmed, a pretty extensive, you know, it wasn't, I mean, we had natural film people with us, it wasn't like snake bites people, you know, I mean, guys that used to film with Jeff Corwin and whale wars and shit like that, so
yeah.
it was really cool, and the footage it's come out really, really good. The weird thing was is that, you know, we were actually filming this to try to pitch it as a pilot to like, you know, Nat Geo or something like that. And ironically enough, just as I got back from the trip to Australia, you know, because basically it was somebody funded the project. You know, they paid for the project. They flew
right.
The crew out. They flew me out, and they were like, yeah, let's do this. And literally I got back from Australia to you know, a deal with another network on another TV show that would make it exclusive. So unfortunately, all this effort that went into this just kind of was for the naught. So we can't sell this to the networks anymore. We, you know, I'm under contract, an exclusive contract. So what we decided to do is rather than just sitting on the Australian footage that, like I said, I mean, we went down, you know, the Adelaide River and fed, you know, wild crocodiles and
yeah.
caught freshwater crocs and, you know, outside of Fog Dam and, you know, just all kinds of crazy stuff like this. So we decided we can put it out on a DVD documentary style. And although we can't sell it to another network, we can still, you know, put it out there. So yeah, it's a great time. And like I said, this time I'm going to be going to the Brisbane area where I have some really great friends, get a chance to hang out with, you know, Steve Irwin's dad, Bob, a little bit. We're going to be hooking up for a little while, hang out with him and just, you know, go out with a lot of the herpers from the area. You know, I've got some friends in the area that assure me that I will catch, you know, carpets, womas, blackheads, not to mention, you know, four or five of the most deadly snakes in the world. So, and they promised me. They're like, I promise you, you will find this stuff when you're there. So
that's awesome.
So we'll be out in the bush a lot doing stuff. Whether or not I'm going to film it, I really just don't know yet. You know, I mean, I know I'll have a camera there and I'll be rolling some stuff. How much, I don't know. Because quite honestly, like when we did the snake bite stuff in Sydney, it was really fun. You know what I mean? It was like, obviously, you know, I got, you know, owned by that Ruffy python. And that was
I fell in love with the rough scale pythons is right there. Is watching you getting freaking owned by that thing. And I'm like, want one so bad right now. It's ridiculous.
You know, it was so funny, guys, because what happened was, you know, I've been, you know, dude, I was like in love with rough scale pythons from the time I saw that the preserved specimen from the frickin' 40s or whatever it was, you know, and they thought that they were extinct. And then what was interesting is I show up to Homebush where the show was. And I'm walking around and I see little baby ruffies and I'm like, oh my gosh. And then I met John Weigel, who was the guy that found them, the first ones. You know, I mean, they thought they were extinct. They didn't even know they existed in the wild. And John's telling me about the story about the ruffy pythons and how he caught them and where they were from and the expedition and all this other crazy stuff. And so I just asked him, I said, hey, I'm going to be filming later on. Can I, you know, film a thing? And the thing that's interesting about a lot of these Australians who are all really good friends of mine now is that they love to kind of put you into precarious positions. You know what I mean? They want, you know, so sure enough, you know, instead of, you know, letting me take out this, you know, 2 or 3 foot, you know, ruffy, John says, oh, I've got this adult over here that's really tame. And so I pull it out of the bag and it immediately just opens its mouth and does the, you know, because they do that wide open mouth
display,
thing,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
exactly. And I knew I was going to get owned, but I'll be honest with you, I was on such an adrenaline rush that I never even felt the thing bite me. I mean, I never felt it. I mean, I was bleeding all over the place and it was just destroying me, but I never felt it. I mean, it was just like holding an animal that I had dreamt about, you know, for 15 years was far greater than the pain that it was causing me. And it was kind of funny because, you know, I was kind of surprised that at the time, and from what I, you know, I gather, I guess we, you know, from the feedback I get from my Australian friends, as well as, you know, the feedback I get through emails and messages, you know, we have a lot bigger following in Australia than we did back then. But I was kind of surprised that there were so many people that knew me. You know what I mean? Like when I went there, I wasn't expecting anyone to know me. I literally didn't think anyone was. So I was kind of surprised that a lot of people knew me. So what was funny was that by the time we filmed this stuff, we were filming, like, we had, like, probably 150 or 200 people watching us filming this ruffy. And so the whole week, the rest of the weekend, the buzz was the crazy American that just got destroyed by a ruffy. You know, and so it was kind of like I almost became a little legend over there
because
of my antics with ruffy pythons. Because the thing is like, that's the one non-venomous snake that, like, no one wants to handle over there because they're just known for not only being aggressive but having such huge teeth, you know. But I can tell you, every bite was worth it. I mean, I loved every minute of it. And I don't have any, but I tell you what, I've been eyeballing those ones that Cameron has at Bushmaster. I'm really, you know, if he still has those.
I want them so badly, it's ridiculous. And people are like, why? It's just a bumpy carpet python. I'm like, you don't understand.
They're just awesome.
Oh, yeah, it's just crazy, you know. And they act really different than carpet pythons. I mean, they really do. They have a very different disposition, not just their aggressiveness, but just the way they – you know, I spent quite a bit of time with John. As a matter of fact, I stayed at John's house for 4 days after the show, and that's where I saw his jet black carpet python. And, you know, so I spent a lot of time around the ruffies over the next week or so, and I did a lot of just kind of staring at them and watching them and messing with them. And they're a very, very different snake. You know, I mean, it's almost like analogous to an Angolan and a ball python. You know, they look similar, but they're very different animals. And although, you know, carpets and ruffies look similar, they're very different animals, no doubt about it.
Do you have any theories of why they might actually have the keeled scales?
You know, I don't know. That's a good question. You know, I mean, other than the fact that they're from extremely rocky outcrops, You know, and John told me, like, you will only find them crammed in between two pieces of slate. You know what I mean? Like, that's mm-hmm. where they live. They don't, they're not like carpets or diamonds where, you know, they're going to be up in the trees and other dens. I mean, these guys are exclusively in rock outcrops. So, you know, mm-hmm. possibly maybe that's what the keel scales are all about, is just the grip. You know, so that they can, you know, not fall out of the rock crevices as they're crawling down a steep, you know, embankment or something like that. I'm assuming that could very well be. And certainly the big teeth and their threat display has to do with their food prey. You know, I guess right. John said what they, you know, they eat the really fuzzy rats that, you know, when they bite them, a normal carpet would just, you know, end up with a mouthful
of
fire.
Yeah,
and instead, and these guys are able to hold on. So, pretty interesting animals, and the, you know, John was had some great stories about finding them. I mean, it sounded like it was an expedition from hell where they literally were stranded, and they didn't. I mean, like, it sounded like it was like scary. You know, like they were out in the middle of nowhere, way out in the bush. You know, way beyond anybody's ability to come save them, and. You know, they ended up, you know, like crossing a river in their four-wheel drive that later on their rains came and the river swelled too much for them to get back across. And
oh
so they literally had to, like, you know, for like 3 days they were camping at the riverside with crocs and stuff like that in the river, and there was no way they could get across the river, and they were like, they didn't know if they were going to even be able to get back, and you know, all kinds of things, like, you know, dehydration was setting in because they didn't have enough water, and I mean, just all, I mean, it was, I mean, when he's telling me his story, and then just miraculously, you know, they finally find the one, you know, one animal, and then they find another one, and it happens to be a pair. You know, amazing story, you know, but those are, that's the one thing I will give to Australians, and I really, really love the Australians I've had a chance to get to know and hang out with, is that their sense of adventure is much greater than us. And the other thing I think that binds their community together is field herping, you know,
yeah.
Like it seems like, you know, sitting around, probably my favorite experience in Australia the times I've been is sitting around one night in Homebush after the reptile show with about maybe 50 or 60 herpers around a couple picnic tables, just around a barbecue, and just listening to the stories. And everyone had stories of, like, out in Kimberley or up in Darwin or, you know, out in WA. I mean, it was like everyone, it was like their whole passion for reptiles evolved around their next herp trip, where they could find that animal that was elusive to them, and I almost felt a little bit bad because I thought to myself, you know, I bet you the majority of the reptile keepers in America probably don't even really know where their favorite snakes are from.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I mean, they may know the continent, but I mean, I'd be willing to bet, and this is, I'm not going out on a limb, I think, by saying this, I would be willing to bet that 90% of ball python people have no idea what country ball pythons come from. You know, they know they come from Africa.
Africa,
but they don't
really where.
But they don't. They have no idea where. And here you have, like, these people from Australia that, like, they're almost like gray band collectors. You know, they know, like, the locality of every single animal. You know what I mean? Like, they can look at an animal that I go, ah, it looks like a carpet. You know, and they'll go, oh no, this is a Murray darling. You know, blah blah. You know what I mean? They know everything about it. And I just think, like, I was jealous of that. I was like, wow, that is just so awesome. You know, and they were just so in tune with it. But they all love to hurt, man. They just love to get out in the bush and go find stuff. You know, and I think that's really cool.
That's awesome. When they were out finding anything, did you just come across any Owen Pelly's pythons?
I knew you were going to ask about the Owen Pelly's.
I have to.
Well, you know, yeah, well, you know, Owen Pelly, it's an interesting story. Owen Pelly's, you know, the government outlawed them, you know, quite a few years ago. And basically any of the ones that were in collections were illegally kept, and they confiscated all of them. Now, there were some rumors that there were a handful that were still in private collections, but it was very much hush-hush, and no one would say who they were and how they were. But interestingly enough, Gavin Bedford up in from Crocosaurus Cove up in Darwin had worked for probably 10 years to get proper permits to find Owen Pelly pythons, okay, the first legally collected Owen Pelly pythons. And he finally, when I was in Darwin, and me and Gab went out. As a matter of fact, I was with him when we caught our carpet python. He took me out to the areas that you know he hunts them, and we found a carpet python and actually an olive python as well. And regardless, he had told me that he was right on the cusp of getting that situated. Well, recently I talked to Gavin about a month or two ago, and sure enough, they went out on their first expedition for Owen Pellies, and they found a female.
Wow.
So there is a female Owen Pellie python in captivity right now.
Wow.
At Gavin's place. And that's the first actual legal Owen Pellie. And I can guarantee you that I am going to do my best when I'm there in November to make it up to Gav's place and at least see the Owen Pellies. And I know he was going back out, you know. I think he has permits to collect, I want to say three pair. It was either three or four pair he had permits to collect. So now that he knows where they're from, it's just a matter of getting back there and finding them.
Right. Wow.
So, yeah. But yeah, I can't. But that's always been one of my, you know, really the two snakes that I was always fascinated with in Australia were Ruffies and Owen Pellie. And so that I got to see Owen Pellie python in person. You know, I've got to see him.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, I've been talking about it again. My itinerary for the trip is still kind of up in the air right now. But I've been talking about getting back up to Darwin, if nothing else, just to go see Gav and his Owen Pellies.
That's awesome. Cool.
Now, as far as wow, you got me excited about the Owen Pellies. I can't think about anything else. I just can't wait to see them.
Yeah,
can I go with you?
No doubt. Yeah, absolutely. Everyone, come along.
Yeah.
So we talked about Snake Bites TV and how you started and everything. But where's the future going? What's going on?
You know, it's really tough. You know, I mean, you know, I unfortunately can't say a whole lot about, you know, the TV side of things, unfortunately, because unfortunately I'm under contract and they don't allow you to say a whole lot about it. But you know, I hope that the future will be, you know, what I really hope is that the future will both be television and internet. I mean, that's my goal. You know, that's my hopes for the future, is that I'll continue to be able to do Snake Bites or something similar to Snake Bites and also have a TV show. There will be, you know, news to come on the TV side of things very shortly. Exactly when, I don't know. It could be this week. It could be 3 weeks from now, 4 weeks from now. But you know, there'll be something on the air, you know, from what I understand, sometime this summer. You know, so, so you know, it'll, you know, we've already filmed. You know, it's done in the can. It's done. And now it's just a matter of the powers that be to make decisions. And then when they make the decisions, they allow me to talk about their decisions. But until they make those decisions, you literally can't even say what network. You can't say. It's a good deal. It's a good thing. And it could be really good for everybody. And then my hopes are is that I'll be able to continue to do Snake Bites or something similar to Snake Bites with their approval. And we did. It's pretty exciting. We just are now involved with a company called Maker Studio, and we just signed on with them, and we're in the integration process right now that, you know, hopefully will be done very shortly within the next week or two. And Makers is basically, I would basically liken it to like the Discovery Channel of the internet. You know, it's like Makers is a company that was formed, an online studio that was formed by the biggest YouTubers. Basically what happened is, you know, 6 or 8 or 10 of the top YouTubers, I'm talking mega YouTubers, you know, I mean, like including Ray William Johnson, who has, you know, 6 million subscribers on YouTube and is the number one YouTuber. They joined together and said, let's make a studio for YouTubers, you know, to help YouTubers grow their audience. And that's what they started. They started Makers about a year and a half ago, and just about a month and a half or 2 months ago, they asked me to join their network. And
oh,
so,
awesome.
Of course, it was a pleasure and an honor for them to ask me. And, of course, I said yes.
Of course, I had to get my attorneys and agents involved from the standpoint that I'm already under contract with something else, and it was a little bit dicey. You know, there was even a time where Makers was going to retract their offer, which was really scary to me because they were like, "Ah, you've got something going on. We might not want to be, you know, putting a lot of energy into your stuff because we don't have control over what's going to happen in the future." And then ultimately they came back and said, "You know what? We're willing to give this a shot." You know, and the shot was really, you know, what I was trying to sell them on is hey, you know, when this TV stuff starts to happen, we can, as a group, you know, the network, myself, and Maker Studio can get together and work as a threesome here at producing, you know, this cool online content that everyone's happy with and everyone can do well. So hopefully that's what the future holds. If nothing else, you know, for the next little while, you know, being involved in Makers should certainly open our, you know, exposure to the show, which hopefully will open the exposure to our hobby, you know, because they're very wide reaching. I mean, they're, you know, and their whole business model is, you know, we take a channel that we feel can break out and become like much larger than it is. And then we put all of our energy into making that channel potentially break out. And then if it doesn't break out, then it just isn't meant to be. You know what I mean? Like, okay, well, you know, didn't work out, you know. And that's basically what they try. So over the next, probably, I mean, once I'm integrated in, which will happen very, you know, within the next week or two at the tops, then it'll start, you know, them starting to help my channel grow, you know. And so, you know, I'm really looking forward to the opportunity of working with them and what they bring to the table. And hopefully, you know, our 1 million views a month will turn into 5 million views a month. You know, I mean, that's what the goal is. And you know, so if we could do that and, you know, TV stuff goes well, you know, we could really be making some pretty major noise here in the next little while. And you know, all of that's going to be funneled to trying to put a positive spin on things. I always say like TV stuff, for instance, is much different because you have to, you know, I can tell you this much. I'm not even going to lie to you. I haven't seen the stuff. I won't see the stuff. Typically when you see your TV show is when everyone else watches your TV show. I mean, they don't pre-show with you. They don't, you know, they don't ask your permission. They don't, you know, they just do whatever. So I have no idea what the show is actually going to be like. Really. I have no clue, but I can tell you this. There's going to be a lot of people that probably don't like it. You know, I know that because it's not going to be, you know, educational interest. You know what I mean? It's going to it's going to be entertaining. It's going to be, we got to get people to watch or it doesn't matter. And this is what I always tell people is that you can have the best message in the world. And if no one listens, what does your message mean? You know what I mean? So by doing the TV stuff, we really realized that, you know, we had to make it really entertaining and really sensational. And ultimately we could use that platform to take our message to the people, you know, but first we needed the platform. And if you don't have a platform, it's really hard to get your message out. So that's, that's the attitude that we came about. Now we didn't try to do anything that we felt would be harmful for the hobby. You know, we really tried to, you know, because trust me, when you're producing stuff or they're producing stuff, they try to get you to do stuff that would be harmful, you know?
Yeah.
You know, they come like, hey, what do you guys think about this? And I'm like, no.
No.
you know, it's like one of these things, like, hey, how about, I kid you, I can't go into too much detail, but I can kid you not that one of our EPs said, would a snake ever get under a house and a kid disappear? And, I mean, this was the conversation I had. I go, no. What? I'm like, what? And he's like, well, I'm just wondering because I think that maybe this could be. And I was like, no. I go, let me just tell you one thing. I said, I will never film with a snake and a kid, okay, ever, period. I said, unless it's a good thing. I said, unless they're happy. I said, there will never be a big snake. There will never be a killer snake. There will never be anything like that that has anything to do with children. You know, and he was like, oh, okay, I was just curious, you know, I thought this might be a good idea, and I'm like, well, it might be a good idea to you, but it ain't going to happen, you know, so they get to try, they try to get you to do stuff, you know, and even they do a lot of, like, those, this is the one thing that's scary is that, like, you know how when you're watching, say, Pawn Stars, and they're negotiating, and then, like, you know, Rick, the, you know, owner or whatever, you know, cuts away to him, and he's going, like, this could be something I'd really like to get if I can get it at the right price. They call those OTFs or on the flies. They're little energy pieces.
And that's how reality TV kind of is based. You know, you've got this, you know, it's kind of like the storyline, you know, they tell the story rather than voiceovers. They tell the story through interviews.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, in an hour long show, there might be, you know, 5 minutes of interviews. I don't know, something like that. They sit you down and they do interviews for like 5 hours.
You know, wow.
Just literally just firing questions off on you. And they're always trying to get you to say things that you don't want to say.
Right.
You know? So,
you
do the best you can do to not say what they want you to say and say it, you know, in a good way. You know, like I'll give you an example. Like part of our show, which is part of what we do, is, you know, we rescue animals. You know, when someone calls me up and says, "Hey, I've got, you know, whatever, a snapping turtle," I'll go get it. You know what I mean? It's something I've done for 20 years. And I either keep it or rehome it to somebody else. It's something I've always done. And they kept on wanting me to talk about extractions, like animal extractions. And to me, it's rescue. It's not extracting. I don't extract animals. I rescue animals. And so, like, you know, you constantly get this, like, extraction. And I would never say the word extraction. I would just never say it. You know, I was like, I'm not saying extraction. I think it's a dirty word. It makes it seem like I'm doing something that's wrong. You know, these people are doing something wrong, and I have to extract their animal from them. No, I'm just going in and rescuing an animal, you know. And so so those are the types of things that you're always really cognizant of. But again, you know, you sit back and you think, man, that's a lot of hours of saying things, and it's pretty easy for them to twist things around and do other things. So it's always a little nerve-wracking, but, you know, you have to take the chance, because I think that the platform that it could potentially give us as a hobby is so potentially huge, and I'm willing to, you know, I think that I've proved it in the past, and I'll continue to try to prove it, is that, you know, I won't keep my mouth shut to keep a show. You know what I mean? It's like, I think that, like, say, for instance, the Burmese thing was going down with the rule change, I wouldn't have sat on my hands because I had a show. Because I can tell you what, the network doesn't want you to say anything about that type of stuff because it's controversial. I would have been, you know, this is the thing. When that whole thing was going down with the Python ban and stuff like that, my agent was trying to get me on Fox News and CNN, and they just were flat turning me down. You know, my agent, who is really well connected with, and he represents a lot of huge names, I'm really fortunate to have him as an agent, he just couldn't get it done, you know, because I was nobody. I was just a YouTube guy, you know. I guarantee you, I have a show on X Network, I get on that show. You know what I mean? They call up and say, hey, you know, Brian from this show wants to come out and debate this thing, because it was making Fox News and it was making CNN. They were talking about it. They just weren't having our side on it, right?
Right. Yeah.
And so,
that's true.
So my point is that, you know, I get that platform, and, dude, I will be all over the place trying to ring good cheer about what we do.
That's awesome.
You know, so that's basically the future of hopefully Snake Bites and, you know, hopefully TV stuff. But I'll do whatever I can do to make the hobby better. But, you know, sometimes you have to be a little bit – like I said, I'm sure some people will be pissed because they'll be like, oh, man, they showed a snake biting Chewy. You know what I mean?
Oh, God, no.
Yeah, and that's – I'm going to get it. I'm prepared for it. I'm ready for it. It's going to happen. But you know, and actually, ironically enough, I don't think that anyone got bit when we were filming the funny thing, but there were some close calls. There were some real close calls, but I don't think anyone actually shed a drop of blood, believe it or not, which I think is good, you know. And the other thing is that I always tell people that, you know, when we do a bite scene or something that's kind of funny, or not funny, but something that's, you know, serious bite type thing, we always try to make it like a joke. You know, like it like we try to make it humorous because we want to take the edge off of it. You know, so when you see this 18-foot python that's trying to bite somebody and you're laughing about it, it doesn't feel like it's serious. You know,
right?
And I know that was one of the things that when we were filming, sometimes the producers would say, God, you guys, you know, are always like everything's like a joke and everything's like you know funny, like you know it's like. You guys don't take it serious. at all. And I'm like, that's right. That's where I want to keep it. You know what I mean? I want to keep it where,
right.
you know, like I'm almost getting eaten because, you know, something is going terribly wrong and you got Chewie in the background making fun of me and being a complete idiot.
Right.
And I think what it does is it makes you laugh at a very, an otherwise very serious situation, you know? And that's ultimately what I hope comes off is that, you know, hey, okay, well, this can't be that serious because these guys are joking around about it, you know?
Yeah, no dramatic music in the background or anything like that, so.
Right, yeah, and we made sure, trust me, there's no way. The one thing I can say is that the close bite scenes that we've done, there's no way they're going to make them feel serious. Because, I mean, it was so over the top, like crazy Three Stooges shit. That there's no way they're gonna edit the Three Stooges part out of those scenes. You know?
Right.
But so hopefully it comes out good. But lots of really fun and exciting things, but you never know what's gonna happen. You know what I mean? You really never do, and the one thing I've learned through the whole process, whether it be the internet show or the TV stuff that we've worked on, is that you just take it one day at a time because you just literally never know, you know, how the end's going to turn out. You know, I mean, even now, even though things look really good and stuff like that, you know, I could get a call tomorrow then just say, we decide we're not going to go forward with it. You know, and you have to realize that. I mean, I think the chances are probably pretty slim, seeing as they, you know, already paid for everything. Normally, they don't, you know, cough after that. But, you know, because it's a lot of money. You know what I mean? It's like it's millions of dollars they put into shows, you know. So they don't normally when they pay that type of money for things, they don't walk away from them. But it can happen. So, you
right.
know, and the one thing I can say is, and, you know, I don't care what happens, if this thing goes and it becomes really successful or not or whatever it is, you know, I'll always be, you know, the same guy. So, and that's one thing, guys, that I think has really helped me, honestly, is I think the YouTube success has really prepared me for potentially success in other areas, you know what I mean? Because you learn how to deal with the kind of accolades that you get all the time, you know what I mean? You get like, oh, I love your show, and all that, you know, and it's great. I mean, you feel really good when people do that, but you learn to, like, not let it get to your head. You know what I mean?
Right.
You learn to, you know, and I think that it would have been harder if we would have went right into television. You know, I wonder if it would have gotten to our heads. I mean, I don't know if it would. I would like to think that I'm not that type of person. But you know, you have to wonder, you know what I mean, when you have that type of success with it, you know, all of a sudden get to your head a little bit. But the fact that we've had 4.5 years of, you know, kind of learning how to, you know, be involved in an audience, so to speak, I think that helps us a lot.
That's awesome. Okay. So, Owen, do you want to?
Oh, you want to keep going with that?
Oh.
All right. Now, Brian, what are some of the ways? I know you're huge on the education and like the putting the positive spin on, you know, reptiles in the world in the community. What are some of the ways that the reptile community can do better to educate, you know, non-reptile people that these things aren't monsters hiding underneath their bed ready to kill everything?
You know, I think it's every day, you know what I mean? Every day and everything you do, you need to continue to do it. I mean, I think obviously, you know, I think everybody should volunteer at a school at least once a year to do a school presentation. I think that that's a must. I mean, if you're a reptile lover, you need to be showing those off to the kids, you know, because those are the future. You know, people always say, you know, kids don't vote, but kids' parents vote. And when a kid comes home from school and he's had a great experience with a bunch of reptiles, I can guarantee you when they're sitting around the dinner table having dinner, that kid's talking about it. You know what I mean? So so I think that's an impact I think everybody should make. I mean, everyone should make that sacrifice. And I don't mean, you know, go to the school and charge them $300. I mean volunteer your time. You know what I mean? Go and say, I will do a free show for this school, you know, once a year or twice a year or however many times. I try to do as many as I possibly can. And up till now, I've never charged. You know, I mean, I've always done them for free. Now, it doesn't mean that I don't want to make money. I mean, it'd be great if I did. But you know, up until now, I've done them all for free. I think that's one thing, and I think the other thing is just, you know, represent the hobby, you know, in as positive a light as you can, you know, and that's, you know, talking to the person you run into on the street, your family members, whatever it might be, social media, and, you know, again, you know, changing one person's mind is pretty powerful, and you just got to take it that attitude, you know, just, you know, trying to change the world one person at a time, that's all we can really do.
Awesome. Cool.
So, and now in your video on making reptile presentations, very interesting video. What do you think is the most important part of making a presentation? I know I used to do educational programs for the zoo I worked for, and I kind of find that getting it so that all the kids can kind of relate to it would be one of the most important things. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it is. And being, you know, I always say the most, to me, the most important thing is to keep it fun. You know, keep it, just keep, especially with kids that are under, say, under 13 maybe. When they're over 13, you can get on a more intellectual level with the kids, you know what I mean, start talking genetics or start talking about physiology or whatever the case may be. And you don't, you still want to make it fun, but you be more informative. When you're under 13 or so, it's all about just keeping them engaged, you know. And by keeping them engaged, it's about, you know, having fun, laughing, joking, you know, having audience participation, you know, getting people, you know, getting those kids like they feel like they're part of the show. You know what I mean? Bringing kids up and putting snakes on them and letting them walk around. And, you know, so I think those things, so, you know, having fun and engagement I think is number one important, because if you go in and just do a boring presentation, they're probably not going to take a whole lot out of it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we try. We try, again, you know, one of my catchphrases and snake bites and everything I do is that we try to edutain people. You know, we're trying to educate through entertainment. And I think that that's how people get the most out of it, is when people can learn something and laugh at the same time.
Yeah, it's true.
That's great. So we're just about to wrap up, but I want to say, like, this has been one of the most fun interviews that we've done, because, you know, it's just you captivate me when you're talking, man. You just grab me with the passion that you have, and you just, you know, it's awesome. So I'm glad you came on.
Thank you.
You're welcome anytime. Well, and
Well, guys, you know, I mean, I thank you for the kind words, and I thank you guys for what you're doing with this show. I mean, I think it's really important to have shows like this, and I know it's a lot of work you guys put into it. I've seen even just the pre-production work that you guys put into our stuff. That's a lot of work, and people that are listening have to understand that you guys are sacrificing a lot of time and energy to do a service for the community.
Yeah.
And you guys need to be commended for that, and it's really important for you guys to keep it going. So, and not only do I appreciate you having me on, but I do appreciate what you guys do as well.
Thank you
very much. And we want to extend to you the I don't know if you heard before the show, but we did we tried to make the carpet community take it to the next level. So we threw a carpet fest this year. And it went over pretty good, and we raised money for US ARC and whatnot. But we're gonna have it again next year, and you're more than welcome to come if you like to come. When we nail down the date, I'll let you know.
Absolutely. So, you can count me in. I mean, as long as I'm not gallivanting around the globe, I'll be there.
Or in Australia, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, but absolutely. Good work on that stuff, for sure.
So our most favorite question that we end with is, if you could have any snake, and I mean, this is probably stretching it for you because you have a lot of snakes that you love, but if you could have anything, nothing, didn't have to worry about anything, what would it be?
Oh, gosh, you know, that's one of the toughest questions that anyone can ever ask me, because I'm such a, you know, the problem with that question is, you know, I love everything. I mean, it's impossible for me to narrow
it down.
It gets
everybody every time.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like there's so much that I want, you know. I mean, you know, I've always wanted a white carpet python. You know, I've always wanted a purple ball python. And hopefully those are things that'll be in my future. But Gosh, I don't know. Gosh, I don't know. I mean, I'm sorry, guys. I don't think I can narrow it down I don't think I could narrow it down to 100 things, let alone one. So I might, awesome. I might have to just end it with, I'm sorry, but I don't know.
Fair enough.
Sounds good to me.
Yep.
Now, what is your most exciting thing for 2012 that you had happen?
Well, you know, so far, we're just rolling, obviously. We're just getting going. But probably the most exciting thing so far that's just happened, as a matter of fact, you'll be the first people that I've broadcasted this about, is I had a ball python that I bought about 6 years ago called a sunset ball python. I bought it for $70,000, and I bred it. And it was one of those animals that I felt was going to either be codominant or not genetic, okay? And so I bred it and produced about 12 or 13 babies, all normal. And there was only three females, and the rest were males, which was kind of a bummer. And so I marked those possible heads. Honestly, I sold every male off to the pet trade for $25 a piece, you know? Because I literally did not think it was going to be recessive. I thought it was either codominant or dominant or not genetic. And so it took me 4 years to raise the females to size. I wasn't even going to breed them this year. And one of my guys, Josh, that works with me, my Python room manager, begged me to breed them back to the sunset, who had been sitting in his cage for 3.5 years with no females whatsoever. And I went ahead and bred them, produced one clutch of eggs from the two females. I pipped the eggs like 3 days ago, and it's freaking recessive.
Oh wow! God.
So I'm stoked. I'm happy. I'm mad at myself for mismanaging the collection the project so badly. But so far that's definitely. I think that it's going to be hard for me to probably outdo that potential thing, because with ball pythons, this will be the first recessive morph of ball pythons that's been proven out in quite a few years.
Yeah.
So it's pretty significant. It's a neat looking snake too. It's a really cool looking snake, and I can't wait to see what it does with other mutations. On its own, it was worth $70,000 to me. So obviously, it was very beautiful. But I think that combined with other things, it's going to be really, really special. And I think it's going to be potentially one of the biggest ball python things going over the next 4 or 5 years. So it's going to be really hard to outdo that potential thing. But we have a lot of really cool stuff that we've already hatched, and a bunch of eggs that are due to hatch over the next month and a half, 2 months. So I think that there's still some really strong things in our future for the year. But again, it's going to be kind of hard to, it was kind of like the year I produced the pinstripe. It was the first clutch I hatched. And I said, well, it's all downhill after this. It's like, no way you could
compared to this.
There's nothing, and I can honestly say, although I'll be excited about seeing every single snake hatch, I don't think that I'll get the feeling that I got a few days ago when I picked those eggs and saw the sunsets in the egg. I don't think that I'll be able to get that feeling again. I mean, I'll be excited, about everything that hatches, but not that like euphoric feeling like, oh my gosh, it's almost like you hit the lotto. So far I'm going to have to say that's probably going to take the cake.
Okay. Jeez. Awesome.
That's awesome.
Congrats.
Yeah. Thank you.
So, how do people get in touch with you? What's your website? What's Snakebite? Facebook, Twitter? What's all that info?
Yeah. Oh, I got a lot there. But, obviously just bhbreptiles.com is my main site. Facebook, you'll find me a lot, on either my, just Brian Barczyk, or facebook.com/snakebitesTV. Also, facebook.com/bhbreptiles, which is more serious. I keep the BHB Reptiles one more business. The Snake Bites one is more whimsical. And then the Brian Barczyk Facebook is very whimsical, where you never know what I'm going to say or do. Twitter, I only have one main Twitter account, which is SnakeBitesTV, so twitter.com/SnakeBitesTV. We do have a Twitter.com/BHBReptiles. Again, that's going to tweet out more you know, specials and you know, up and coming events and stuff like that, a little more serious business stuff. And then, of course, anyone can email me at bhp@comcast.net anytime. So so those are the main things. And then, of course, YouTube is youtube.com/snakebitesTV. So, and quite honestly, you can just, you know, anyone that's interested that doesn't know, they can just Google, you know, either Snake Bites TV or BHP Reptiles, and it's pretty easy to find me.
Okay.
I'm out there a little bit, so it's just pretty easy to figure out who I am.
Awesome. And Snake Bites TV comes out every Wednesday, right?
Every Wednesday, yes, sir. Though the next one will be out in about 8 hours. So,
awesome.
So yeah, it's always fun. As a matter of fact, every Wednesday for, gosh, 227 weeks, I think it's been now.
Wow.
Wow.
So yeah, 227 weeks in a row, we haven't missed a Wednesday. So it's been a wild run, considering I really, you know, thought we'd have 6 or 10 shows. And here we are, 200 some shows later. It's been it's been a wild ride, and I just pray that we'll be able to do 200 more weeks, you know, going forward. I really do.
Yeah, awesome.
Awesome. All right, so thanks again, Brian, for coming on, and really enjoyed the show, and you know, just congrats on all your accomplishments. So.
Yeah, well, thank you, guys. You know, like I said, thanks for having me on, and certainly I thank everyone that you know, persevered through the last 2 hours of my ramblings, and, you know, I appreciate everyone's part in everything, so thank you so much.
Okay.
We'll definitely have to have you back on for this one, especially if you end up going to Oz and poking around with some Owen Pellies. You're going to have to come on and just gloat to us for a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Hey, man, whenever you guys want me, I'm here for you, man. You just let
me
know.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thanks again, Brian. Have a good night, okay?
All right. You guys too, man. Take care.
You too. Right. Bye-bye.
That was an awesome show. Awesome.
That was.
Oh, yeah.
Man, is a wealth of information. It is insane. And definitely loving that. So it was a very nice show.
So here we are at the end of the thing. I just give our shout-outs real quick, and then
go for it.
We'll get ready for next next.
I can go to bed.
All right. As I said at the beginning, make sure you go check out Morelia Python Forum. That's at www.moreliapythons.com. The awesome forum if you're into carpets or Morelia. Check out Morelia Python Radio at www.moreliapythonradio.com. You can check us out on Facebook, Morelia Python Radio. You can check out Morelia Pick of the Week, which is a pretty cool little thing that everybody posts up their cool shots of Morelia. Check us out on Twitter, Morelia Python Radio at twitter.com. And check out the Carpet Fest website at www.carpetfest.com. And I just want to give a shout out to Howard Redding, and make sure you go look at RedingReptileBreeders.com. And I believe he's doing a show. When is Hamburg?
June 7th? Yes, June 9th. Is, yes. He'll be up in Hamburg. I unfortunately will be at a wedding, so I will not be able to attend.
Yeah, so go check out Howard. Check out RedingReptileBreeders.com. It'll be there, and say hello to him.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I forgot his name. What the hell's his name? The little guy.
Take your time. What?
Who?
Huh?
The little guy. His little buddy.
Oh.
The one with his finger in the air.
His cardboard child.
Carl. Yeah, I couldn't remember his name. I'm sorry, Carl.
Right, Carl. And remember, for just $1 a day, you could send Carl to a doctor or school. Much needed, because I don't think Howard lets him leave the house. So I'll be having collections and donations and stuff later.
There
on
you
Carl's
go.
Behalf, yeah.
So, that's all I got. What do you got, Owen?
I got nothing. Rogue-reptiles.com. Also, there's Rogue Reptiles on Facebook. We're doing lots of updates. Expect pictures of numerous animals, including our new granite male, Aranjaya, het female, as well as all our Malukan scrubs will be posted pictures of soon. White Lips, Waters, everything's getting its picture taken. I'm kind of done blinding my reptiles with flash bulbs. It's crazy. And then also we're going to have very interesting news in the next couple of days. Carmel Tigers are expected to hatch out soon. So, yes, that's all I got.
Nice.
All right.
Very good.
Yes.
Okay.
So what's happening next week?
I didn't confirm with the – it's supposed to be Don Patterson.
Okay. So we have to confirm with that. Otherwise, we'll be doing one of those Audible shows where Luke will probably be on. So,
yeah.
Yes, we really got to get more people that we can call on a moment's notice. But anyway, I look forward to it no matter what it is. So, all right, everybody, we're out of here. So good night, everyone. Have a safe doing whatever it is you're doing, and we'll see you all next week.
Very good.
Good night.
Good night.